Board members and staff, please turn on your phones. Phones, microphones. Thank you. Perfect timing. Good morning again. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order on January 12, 2024, at 9:03 a.m. Could I please have a roll call?
Kimberly Bailey.
Present.
Robert Charles.
Here.
Mary Coonrod.
Here.
Lynette Hennigan. Polly Knapp. Megan Kramer.
Here.
Adelisa Meek.
Here.
Diane Palacios.
Hello, good morning.
Mark Shen.
Here.
Antoine Trotter.
Present.
Thank you. My name is Adelisa Meek. I'm a licensed professional counselor, a licensed independent substance abuse counselor, and the board's chairperson. At this time, I would like to remind everyone to please make sure that your phone is on silent or turned off. For your convenience, throughout the meeting, vending machines are right outside this room and the restrooms are across from the elevators. A couple of reminders. This is an open meeting and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. Please be sure, if you are speaking on the record, that you speak clearly and into the microphone. In order to protect privacy, please keep in mind if it is necessary to refer to a client or former client, to please use initials only, including if they are complainant. At this time, I will ask my fellow board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Bob Charles, public member.
Antoine Trotter, public member.
Good morning, Mark Shen, professional member.
Hello, I'm Diane Palacios, professional member.
Mary Coonrod, public member.
Megan Kramer, public member.
Kimberly Bailey, professional member.
Aaron Yabu, deputy director.
Jared Carver, investigations manager.
Toby Zavala, executive director.
Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general representing the board. Good morning.
Thank you. We will now move to agenda item number three, which is review of the minutes for December 8, 2023. We're going to table that item for the next meeting as we have no quorum. The next item on the agenda is the consent agenda, item number four. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff. Board members have reviewed all of the materials and the recommendations. We are prepared to vote on each matter as it appears on the agenda. Before doing so, I will call each matter to see if anyone is here who wishes to pull the matter. What it means to pull the matter is that you are a party to that matter, you do not agree with the recommendations, and would like to have up to 5 minutes to address the board. If you do wish to pull a matter, please raise your hand when I call it so I can take note that you're here. So we'll go to item 4A1, Elizabeth Gonzalez. Four A2, Crystal King. 4A3, Lori Swan. 4A4, Elizabeth Jasek. Are you the complainant?
Okay.
And you wish to pull the matter? Thank you. So, can we listen to the summary from board staff? And
Madam Chair, my suggestion would be that we do a vote on 4A1 through 3.
Do I have a motion?
Palacios.
Bailey, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries to dismiss 4A1 through 3. And now the complainant for Elizabeth Jasek can come to the front.
And we are waiting for the licensee and the attorney to be on the phone.
Hello?
It'll just be one moment, Madam Chair. We're making that call to them.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, may I suggest we wait one more minute, and if not, we may have to pause and go to the next case while we get them on.
Okay. Thanks.
Madam Chair, since it's taking a while for them to come on, I do suggest that maybe we go to the next agenda item and come back to this one.
Okay, thank you.
Just for the sake of time.
So we're moving to agenda item 4B. Cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. Thank you. Lauren Kaiser, are you pulling the case? Okay, thank you.
I believe that the complainant has pulled the matter.
Is the complainant here?
Oh, my apologies.
No, that's, yeah, that's the board, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. Going back. Okay, so do I have a motion to dismiss with a letter of concern?
Palacios moves.
Second.
Kramer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And should we wait or move to the next one, Ms. Zavala?
We should go to the next one.
Next one. Okay. So now we're going to item 4D, cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. Michael Colassa? You're the complainant? Okay. Is the licensee present? Okay. Thank you. So the complainant, you can come to the front. And if you don't mind, turn the microphone on. Thank you. So first, we're going to listen to a summary from board staff. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter was placed on the consent agenda for an acceptance of a non-disciplinary consent agreement. Given the areas of concern identified in the investigative report, board staff contacted licensee to discuss the option of entering into a non-disciplinary consent agreement, which would specify the following. Although the information provided is not of sufficient seriousness to merit direct action against her, the board is issuing an NDCA based on licensee's continuing conduct. Within 12 months, licensee shall complete 3 clock hours of continuing education addressing behavioral health ethics and 3 clock hours addressing Arizona documentation. And again, the licensee has agreed to this and it's signed and is presented to you for your review.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for board staff? No? Okay, so you may address the board. You have up to 5 minutes.
Okay. I have several questions, actually. The first being that the difference between non-disciplinary and disciplinary. With or without the consent is fine.
Thank you. So the board has a number of different options that they can take when reviewing a matter. In order for them to find a violation to make it be disciplinary, it needs to be clear and convincing evidence as well as support a disciplinary action on it. In this matter, it was reviewed by board staff, And there was a concern in the fact of the writing of the letter. However, it didn't appear that it rose to the level of disciplinary action.
Understood.
So it will be non-disciplinary action. It will be a public record for the remaining time of the licensee. It'll also remain on our board's website for 5 years.
Okay. And the second question is that my understanding is that any of these procedures, so for when I file the complaint, that's to remain confidential. Is that not correct?
That you would remain confidential?
That the complaint itself would remain confidential? Or would it necessarily be disclosed to the client?
It would not be disclosed to the client, but it is a public record, so it would be on our website.
Okay. So I guess really what I'm here to speak about this morning is the impacts of this incident and the reason for the complaint. And in looking at, you know, as a layperson, looking at your rules 32-3251 M, R, T, and Y, the letter that Mr. Colossa presented to his client was utilized in a family court setting and has gone beyond the scope of Mr. Colossa's licensure as an LMFT, which is part of that criteria, I understand. The bigger concern really is the impact of that, in which case the letter was shared with the client. So that confidentiality was breached. So there's not really just one violation here. There's actually two, from what I understand. And not just that I would potentially be entitled to file a secondary complaint against Mr. Colossa for violating that confidentiality and sharing the complaint with his client. I have several documents if I could share.
If you could bring them to me.
Sure. This one marked Exhibit 1 was something that was used in the family court, and that's a copy of Mr. Colossa's letter. The other two are pleadings that were filed on behalf of Mr. Colossa's client with the family court in Maricopa County against me to try and silence this complaint, in which case I had to enlist the help of my attorney and incur the fees and costs to represent the rebuttal of that. The court did issue a minute entry in my favor in that I am entitled to make the complaint. I was not forced to withdraw this complaint, but that the court-appointed advisor's report that's necessarily part of our family court case is to remain confidential. So I also have a minute entry from the court to share with you.
Madam Chair, may I ask the complainant a question?
Just yes,
for clarification?
Please. Yeah.
These documents that you're providing us now, you did not provide them to board staff at the time of the investigation. Is that correct?
That's correct, because this came after my complaint and after we were too far along because of the slow process of the family court. So this was happening. My complaint came in, then this was filed with the court after the fact.
And Madam Chair, members of the board, I respect that, but when an investigation is open, at any time we're able to gather information. It's also my understanding, I believe, that we did an interview with you.
Uh-huh.
And
I believe that I did disclose that the letter was shared, and I mentioned that that would be necessarily grounds for a secondary complaint against Mr. Colossa. Mm-hmm. The bigger issue here is not just that he shared it with his client, but also that there was other information that Mr. Colossa was not privy to, that he made statements testifying to the client's relative mental health status that he didn't necessarily have information for and has gone on beyond the scope of his licensure because he's not actually licensed to make those tests and to qualify for those tests to determine those things.
If I may interrupt you for a second, I think that right now we need to address the fact that we're presented with new information.
And Madam Chair, you know, it's my understanding from board staff that we did ask for this information, not provided that information. So, you know, based on the information that's been passed around today, I ask that the board members possibly consider tabling the matter because I don't consider it a full investigation. You know, I recognize that you may have shared that information with us, but board staff, we gather factual information.
Yes.
If somebody shares something with us, we might put it in the interview, but until we have factual documents mm-hmm. to provide it as part of the investigation, we're unable to include that in our recommendation to the board.
I would appreciate that. I would appreciate that we look a little bit further because I have several other things, including the fact that Mr. Colossa may have not been aware that I have two orders of protection against his client.
So Madam Chair, yeah. I think just for the sake of time for today, and again, I want to be very clear to the board members this is information we did request because we were not in a position to come before the board without a full investigation, because then our recommendation may not be based on the facts. So I'm asking that the matter be tabled, and then I'm asking for the complainant to be available for board staff to reach out to gather additional information so that we can bring it back before the board, whether it's the same recommendation or a different one. But not having some of this factual information, I'm uncomfortable going with what board staff is recommending today.
Can I make a request? I'm not saying I'm not in favor of that, but would it be appropriate first to hear from the complainant's counsel before we decide to do that?
I think it's up to you, Madam Chair, members of the board. I feel like, and maybe we give them a brief opportunity to share something, but again, I just am not comfortable moving forward with any recommendation from board staff without the entire investigative record, because based on what I've seen, this may change our recommendation.
I think we should give them a chance to speak, and then I do think it probably makes sense to table it.
And at any point, too, I wasn't necessarily requested specific documentation, or I would have done that. The webpage, unfortunately, is really clunky on the initial complaint form, and it gives you a limitation of the number of pages and the data bytes that you can attach in the initial complaint. Okay. But this came
just
the,
so we if can, we could just maybe move forward for the sake of time. So we're going to allow the licensee and the attorney to come forward.
So, Madam Chair, can I just clarify real quickly to the complainant? I respect the matter to the portal itself, but I do know that you've been in contact with the investigator. With that being said, we'll take these three documents. We will reach out to you at a later time. Mm-hmm. We don't know what documents to ask for because we don't know what documents you have.
Sure.
So any documents that you can have to solidify what you've alleged would be appropriate. But as Madam Chair said, we will hear from the licensee and their attorney, and then we'll table the matter and then further the investigation at a later time.
I'd appreciate that because in my perspective from this is, you know, I really would like to request disciplinary action rather than a non-disciplinary action due to the scope of this.
We will bring the matter again
yes.
in a future meeting.
Great.
That will be the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, while they're switching places, the board doesn't put a limit on how much information we can review. And so just for the people listening, you know, if there's some limitation based on the website or something like that, you know, obviously, we will accept more information over email or something, I'm sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have several more documents just for the record that I would like to provide.
Just contact your investigator. That will be the best way. Thank you. Mr. Carey.
Good morning, Chair Meeks, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for Mr. Colasa. Those documents are from early 2023. She filed a supplemental response where she raised a whole raft of new arguments. This is a dead issue. It was already litigated. She brought up in her complaint the concern about what was shared, what wasn't shared, and investigators actually asked Mr. Colasa about that. Those documents are from early 2023, is my guess. So she had ample time, and this is really not an opportunity for people to retread their case when they don't like what the answer is. The reality of this is that he wrote a letter. LMFTs are allowed to write letters. There are certainly some constraints about that. And you are doing a lot to start educating your membership about how to not write letters, or if you write letters, keep them very clear. But this letter is well within his scope. And if you look at the letter, it doesn't opine on anything that was not directly observed. If either of the attorneys had brought him into court under a subpoena, he would be able to testify about the exact same things. Because he didn't opine about the mother in the case. He didn't opine about the kids in the case. He opined about what was in the four corners of his treatment. So I think that these documents, and I think Toby or Jared can confirm that for you, they're early 2023. There may be some new minute entries, but I've kind of kept an eye on the family law case, and I think they're pretty early in the case. And so if she failed to bring those up during a full opportunity to respond, you know, it's not a free for all. The decisions were made based upon what the investigative report revealed, and it was also based upon an interview. And this is a case where the complainant clearly knows how to submit more information because she did it a second time around. That was the second time where she made the improper claim and completely bogus claim that my client and the client went to Burning Man together, which obviously was not an accurate claim. So my suggestion is this is not new information. This is information that was clearly within her scope and control, and we do have to draw the investigative line somewhere and resolve this case. So we would just suggest you accept the NDCA.
Thank you. I think that we would like to review those as board members, and I really appreciate your comments. Okay, so we'll table this.
Do we need a motion or no?
We need a motion.
Do we need, no, we don't need a motion. Okay, thank you. And that concludes this matter for now. Are we ready to move to
B? 4B?
B.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Lori Kaiser?
Right.
I'm sorry, it's 4A4.
It's the JSEC, right?
Yeah, Elizabeth JSEC. Thank you. Thank you, CA.
Morning.
Good morning.
Can we just confirm that we have the attorney and the licensee on the phone?
Oh, we already called?
They called in.
Yeah.
Oh, hello. Good morning. This is Adalisa Meek from the Board of Behavioral Health. Is this Bruce Smith and Elizabeth Jasek?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, members of the board. This is Bruce Smith.
Okay. Thank you. I would ask that just a reminder that this is a public meeting. It will be recorded. I'm here with fellow board members, board staff, and members of the public. And so we're going to get started by listening to a summary from board staff. And I ask that if you're on the phone, that you put your phone on silence for now. Isabella?
Yes. Chairperson Meek and members of the board, this matter was placed on the consent agenda because following a review of the investigative record, it didn't appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. Additionally, I want to share with you that there was a small supplement that was uploaded to the member portal. Does not change anything in regards to the board staff's recommendation. It's basically a supplemental statement as well as sharing information in regards to higher education courses that the licensee took. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Zavala? No? Okay. So first we're going to listen from the complainant. CA, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Yes. So I would just like to start off with saying that I do have a degree in neuroscience and cognitive science with an emphasis in cognition from the University of Arizona, where I am also a research technician in the lab. I brought this complaint before the board because I am also non-binary. I use they, them pronouns. And this was a case of intentional misgendering and unethical conduct. Elizabeth, at several times during this course, I was working on publishing a paper in a scientific journal, which did get published eventually. But because of this case, I had to pause work for a full month and then come back. And I would just like to ask for you if it is ever appropriate conduct for a licensee to call a client pathetic or for a licensee to decide that a particular client needs to stand up for themselves. Is that ever appropriate conduct?
We are not here to answer questions at this point. But
I understand that this is a very much he said, she said case, but I would just like to put on the grounds that I am concerned about the licensee's ethical conduct. And I am aware that, unfortunately, there is not much precedent for my particular case. However, this is why I'm here. I'm here to set precedent.
Do you have anything else on your statement?
I'm so sorry. I would just like to say that this was also in a group setting. At no point was it ever made that I wanted individual counseling or that she was able to provide individual counseling. This also happened in a group setting with other clients. So she decided for me what my thoughts and my feelings were, and then decided to not even answer another client's concern. She dragged me into this way of trying to explain to another client that they were not at fault, because I had already talked to the other client and said, I understand that you made a mistake. It's fine. I noticed. I appreciate it. However, that client still experienced distress. In what case is it that a licensee decides to bring in another client to deal with that client's distress? And that's what happened here, is that I was dragged into this situation because Elizabeth does not know how to handle LGBTQ issues. And I am queer. I am queer until the day I die.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions for the complainant? Okay, thank you. You can go back. And Ms. Jasek, Mr. Smith, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. Are you still there?
I am.
Yes, go ahead.
The chairperson, Meek, and members of the board, I would like to share, I provided the board with a very detailed response to the allegations. I'm not going to provide another summary of everything that I said. This case is a personal charge against me. What I would like to do is spend a few moments about my character. When I went to college, my academic training emphasized the differences in cultures around the world and stressed cultural relativism. I learned from an anthropological perspective that cultural differences do not mean that one culture is better than another, something I had already had instilled in me from an early age. Cultural differences are to be embraced and celebrated, and my college courses merely provided an academic perspective to what I had already learned growing up. I was raised in a home with a lesbian mother and a step-parent who identifies as non-binary, who have always guided me to be open and accepting of others' differences. My son is gay, my sister is bisexual, all of whom I have supported and loved and have good relationships with. I have fully embraced the LGBTQ plus community for years. I've gone to parades. I've celebrated. I have a very supportive relationship with the people in my life who are part of the LGBTQ plus community. I love and respect them. And I do not discriminate against members of the LGBTQ plus community. I do not discriminate against anyone, including transgender individuals or patients. In my response, I quoted from two articles that CM cited. One of those articles from the AMA Journal of Ethics says that misgendering is the repeated use of the wrong pronoun. A second source condemns intentional misgendering, or I am not guilty of intentionally using the wrong pronoun or repeatedly using the wrong pronoun when referring to CM. From my first group session with CM on March 20th of last year to my final session, my charting reflects that I use the words they and their. I use CM's preferred pronouns on March 20th, March 22nd, March 24th, March 27th, March 29th. I use the patient's preferred pronouns in my documentation regarding the three group sessions in early April 2023. Am I perfect? No. I admit that I used the wrong pronoun on the afternoon of April 7th. I also noted that an incorrect pronoun once in a treatment plan section of a note. I did not mistreat CM, however. I did not use kindness to cover up what I had said and provided the same compassion, empathy, and support I provide to all my clients. I am proud to be a counselor. I enjoy helping my patients and clients. I'm empathetic and compassionate, and I strive to treat all my LGBTQ plus patients with dignity and respect. I'm happy to answer any questions that the board members may have for me.
Thank you. Do any board members have questions for the licensee?
I have one. This is Megan. I'm just wondering, what is your practice if, you know, misgendering inevitably happens when folks make mistakes? What is your practice when you do misgender someone?
I've persistently tried to correct it if I accidentally say the wrong gender. And I quickly correct it, and I've apologized. This client did not give me an opportunity to apologize. when I asked to speak with them. But I did, in the session, check in with the client and ask them how they were doing.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else from Ms. Jasek? No more questions? So now this is the time for the board to deliberate, and we ask that we're not interrupted. And if you're on the phone, you can put your phones on silence again, please. And we have Dr. Bailey, you're leading this discussion.
Yeah. I think we have a lot of different things that happen in therapy, right? There or allegedly happen in therapy. And unless we have materials that help us decide that it actually happened, since we weren't there, we can't just assume, you know, on each defense, right? That he said, she said, could keep going all day long trying to defend each other's positions. And I respect that. I respect us wanting to present or defend what we feel happened. In this case, though, I just, it appears that we don't have any evidence that suggests, that could give us clear and convincing evidence that the complaint, that it happened. What I do see, though, is if we did not have, if this wasn't a good fit, the proper, it appears, the material seems to support that we had proper referrals, and that's what we're looking for is, you know, if also this treatment wasn't going to happen or whatever was happening at this place, that if it wasn't the right fit, that we then also did our secondary obligation, which is to try to get some options. And that does appear from the materials to be supported. So I would suggest that we just align with the findings that we dismiss the case. It doesn't rise to the level of clear and convincing for us to make any other decision.
Which we're bound to under the law, so.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other discussion? Or are we ready to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we dismiss.
Second, Kramer.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much for all the participants. We are not now completed this case. Now we move to item 4I, cases recommended for release from consent agenda agreements. We have I 1 through 6. Do I have a motion to release?
Bailey, so moved.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The next item is number 7 on the agenda. This is the time and place scheduled for the board review of disciplinary matters. This we will be hearing that pursuant to the authority given by ARS 323281. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice, which included a list of potential actions that the board could take once we reach deliberation. This list of potential actions does not exclude any other options that the board may discuss. Board members have reviewed all the materials submitted for each case. The board will first hear a summary of the case from board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional, will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking do not take time repeating information the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will collectively be given the same amount of time that the board staff took to present the case, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Once the board has heard from the parties, we will move into deliberation. We ask during this time that you do not interrupt, as it is our time to talk amongst ourselves. If it is necessary at any time to refer to a client or former client, please use initials only, including if they are the complainant. And please keep in mind that the board has a civility policy that prohibits disorderly conduct, and those in violation will be asked to leave the meeting. We go to item 7A. Christine Carrillo is the complainant here, is the licensee. Oh, okay.
That's okay. We can just go on to the next one.
Okay, so that would be...
Seven B.
Julia Gunther is the complainant here.
We need to call the complainant.
Okay, we're going to call the complainant, and the licensee is here. You can move to the front, licensee and Mr. Carey.
Hello?
Yes, good morning. Is this Ellie Oliver?
Yes, it is.
Good morning. This is Adalisa Meek. I'm the Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's Chairperson. And just to let you know that we're ready to address the case for Julia Gunther. And
yeah.
Just a reminder that this is a public meeting. It will be recorded. And I am sitting here with members of the board, board staff, and members of the public. So what we're going to do is we're going to listen to a summary of the case first, and then you will have an opportunity to address the board. And then the complainant will have an opportunity to address the board. Later, the board will deliberate and come up with recommendations. So at this time, if you're on the phone, if you can just please put your phone on silent, we really appreciate it. So can we hear a summary from board staff?
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16KK, failing to make client records and licensee's possession promptly available to the client, a minor client's parent, the client's legal guardian, or the client's authorized representative upon receipt of proper authorization to do so. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 9/20, licensee has been treating client one at private practice for anxiety. Complainant represents in 8/22, she called licensee via phone and left voicemails asking licensee to return her voicemail and requested client one's medical records. During board staff's investigative interview, licensee acknowledged that she believed in one of the voicemails complainant left her. Complainant was requesting client one's clinical records. Licensee represented she never replied to any of complainant's attempts to contact licensee for the following reasons. The name complainant left in the voicemail was not the name licensee had in legal documents. Licensee had no way of verifying that complainant was client one's mother. Father had sole legal custody at the time complainant reached out. Despite licensee's representation that father had sole legal custody of client one, a 7/16/21 court agreement indicated the following. Under Arizona law, unless otherwise provided by court order or law, on reasonable request, both parents are entitled to equal access to documents and other information concerning the children's education and physical, mental, moral, and emotional health, including medical, school, police, court, and other records. Nowhere in the 7/16/21 court agreement does it indicate complainant is not able to obtain client one's medical records. Rather than providing the records to complainant upon request, licensee ignored complainant and never made any efforts to address complainant's request. Despite licensee representing that complainant did not request records per her procedures, complainant was never provided licensee's notice of privacy practices, which outlined how a client would obtain their records. It is highly concerning that licensee believed she could refuse to provide complainant her minor child's records where there's no court records or information indicating complainant, in fact, did not have legal parental rights over client one. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client as it relates to the following sections of the ACA Code of Ethics. A8, multiple clients, and B5B, responsibility to parents and legal guardians. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 9/20, licensee has been providing services to client one at private practice. From 10/22 to 3/23, licensee provided behavioral health services to client two. From 12/20 to 5/23, licensee has been providing services to father at private practice. At the onset of both father's and client two's services, licensee failed to document anywhere within the clinical records her prior relationship with the various family members. Licensee, in fact, was already client one's individual therapist when she began services with father and client two and failed to document how she would be able to remain objective in each client's treatment and her role as their individual therapist, being that she was treating multiple members of a family. At the onset of client one and client two's therapy, licensee did not contact complainant or attempt to contact complainant regarding complainant's minor children initiating services. Additionally, father was having conversations around his children during his individual therapy with licensee, possibly blurring licensee's professional role and responsibilities since she was actively treating client one and subsequently client two. It is unclear how licensee established appropriate roles being an individual therapist for both client one and father, since there were discussions around client one during father's therapy sessions. A 1-14-21 progress note indicated father asked if licensee could bring complainant back into the picture, and there's no documentation that licensee made any effort to involve complainant. It appears licensee, in fact, excluded complainant from her minor children's therapy without making any effort whatsoever, even after father's request. Additionally, licensee did not see treating multiple family members as a conflict and often treats multiple members of a family. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice their profession. This recommendation is based on the following. During the course of Client 1's treatment with licensee, Client 1 self-disclosed self-harming behaviors. Specifically, during a 5-4-22 session, licensee and Client 1 discussed Client 1's self-harming, and if she were to cut herself, licensee would have to report it to her parents. According to this note, there does not appear to be any sort of suicide or risk assessment completed to determine Client 1's level of suicidality. And licensee simply notates there is no suicidality or danger to self present. In a subsequent session on 5-18-22, the progress note indicates Client 1 reported to licensee she was not honest about self-harming behavior and that she had cut herself about a month ago. Licensee again does not document any sort of suicide or risk assessment. Licensee simply documents she would report self-harming behavior to Client 1's parents, but there's no subsequent documentation within the record that licensee reported these self-harming behaviors to the parents. Licensee acknowledged not completing any sort of safety plan with Client 1 and reported that she told Client 1 to talk with her parents about the cutting and believed Client 1 would do so. Furthermore, licensee admitting that cutting can be a sign of suicidal ideation, but did not see cutting as suicidal ideation for Client 1. Licensee does not have any sort of suicide or risk assessments or safety plans that she utilizes. Licensee failed to adequately or appropriately assess Client 1's suicidality after she reported self-harming behaviors. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to the following. Consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record, financial and billing records, confidentiality, and telepractice. This recommendation is based on the following. The informed consents for Client 1 were missing 3 minimum requirements. The informed consents for Client 2 were missing 2 minimum requirements. The telehealth consents for Client 1 and Client 2 were missing 4 minimum requirements. Father's informed consents were missing 4 minimum requirements. The 921-20 treatment plan for Client was not updated annually as required by board rules and was missing 4 minimum requirements. Licensee failed to devise any sort of treatment plan for father or client two. All of the progress notes for client one, client two, and father were missing one requirement. During the course of treatment, licensee was contacted by a court advisor where licensee discussed client one and client two with the court advisor and used each client's name. Licensee failed to obtain any sort of written consent or authorization to speak with the court advisor, inappropriately breaching client one and client two's confidentiality. Furthermore, licensee did not document the conversation she had with the court advisor anywhere within the records. Due to the documentation concerns noted in these clinical records, board staff subpoenaed 3 random clinical records to verify whether the same deficiencies would be found in the other records. AG's clinical records included the following deficiencies. A 3-26-21 consent for treatment was missing 2 minimum requirements. A 4-23-21 treatment plan was missing 4 minimum requirements. CM's clinical records included the following deficiencies. A 9-28-20 consent to treat was missing 2 minimum requirements. A 10-7-20 treatment plan was missing 4 minimum requirements. SS's clinical records included the following deficiencies as well. A 4-20-23 informed consent was missing 4 minimum requirements, and a 5-30-23 treatment plan was missing 3 minimum requirements. It is concerning that licensee has been independently licensed with the board since 2013 and has failed to ensure clinical documentation she utilizes meets all minimum requirements. Furthermore, in 2019, 2021, and 2023, licensee submitted her LAC renewal applications with the board, where she was required to complete the Arizona Statutes and Regulations tutorial, which provides education and training on Arizona clinical documentation standards. Since being notified of these deficiencies with her documentation, licensee provided board staff updated templates, which appear to meet minimum requirements. Additionally, there was a supplement uploaded this week that licensee and her attorney provided, and that is all I have. Unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Any board members have any questions? Staff? No? And so right now, the complainant, you have up to 8 minutes to address the board. Are you still there, Ms. Oliver?
Yes, I'm sorry. It's kind of hard to hear you. I apologize.
Oh, okay. You have up to 8 minutes to address the board now.
Oh, okay. I don't really have too much more to add. What the gentleman described just now is the majority of what my concerns were as well. At the time, the therapist began treating my daughter in 2021. I actually did have joint legal custody of her still. I believe father was awarded sole medical and legal decision making only in approximately April of 2021, but I am still 50% her legal guardian. And then when she began treating my son, I was notified about it from my son himself, and he told me that his father told him that I was not supposed to know. I'm sorry, it's upsetting. I apologize.
That's okay. Take your time.
My son told me that his father said to keep it a secret from me and that it was just supposed to be a dad's house only thing. And it just, again, I'm really sorry. You try to protect your children and something like this happens when under the care of someone who's supposed to be a professional. So, I don't know what has been discussed with my children. And this is actually the first time I've ever heard that my daughter was cutting. They didn't know that. It also came to my attention that the therapist provided the voicemail that I left for her to the children's father, and he has submitted them as court evidence in a custody case that is currently ongoing. And it just felt like a huge violation that a confidential voicemail I left for someone who is, again, supposed to be a professional in treating my children is sending my voicemails directly to my ex-husband. So it just feels like one violation after another. And ultimately, all I want is a copy of my children's record and to not have my children see this woman again. The custody evaluator who contacted her last year provided a report to the court in approximately July, I believe. And in her report, she stated that it was her recommendation that none of our children see Ms. Gunther ever again due to everything that we've been discussing so far. So that is pretty much everything else I have to add. Again, I've never been contacted by her, and I've stopped continuing to try and contact her because I didn't want to breach the lines of harassment or anything like that, trying to obtain the records from my children. So under the advice of my legal counsel, that's why I filed this complaint. So I appreciate you looking into it and taking the time to consider everything.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. Does anybody have any questions for the complainant? There are no questions, so if you can put your phone again on silence, we appreciate it. And now is going to be the time for Ms. Gunther and Mr. Carey to address the board. You have up to 8 minutes.
Chair Meek, members of the board, there are a lot of moving parts on this, so I don't really have a overarching discussion. I'm really going to just go through each of these items and talk to you a little bit about each one. I want to start with the conflict of interest finding. This one's based upon ACA Code A8, which requires that the counselors to clarify at the outset the nature of the treatment and the relationships. And if there's a possible conflict, the therapist is supposed to adjust it in some way up to and including withdrawing. There's no evidence in this case of any real conflict among the clients. The different members of the family, which is the dad and two kids, were all aware of the licensee's role, and each of them came to their individual treatment with their own concerns. If you look at the charts, they weren't really overlapping. It wasn't child one complaining about child two complaining about dad. It wasn't a lot of that type of triangulation. I think there's really no requirement under A8 that we silo people. Otherwise, family counseling would not exist. I think the real problem here is that there was a documentation failure in being able to communicate how this counselor engaged with each of these people and the fact that made it very clear what her role was. That does need to be charted. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you the documentation was what it needs to be. That's not my role today, and I don't defend things that you can see that there's some deficiencies. But I don't believe that there's any evidence of a real conflict. I think a real conflict would be something along the lines of a therapist providing counseling to a couple and then simultaneously providing individual counseling to one of the members of the couple. That's the type of conflict that A8 is really contemplating. As for mother being involved in this, she's not a client. So even though she and licensee did come into disagreement, there's no conflict of interest there. It's really only appropriate when the treatment of one client affects the ability to fairly treat the other. And there's just simply no evidence, let alone clear and convincing evidence of that. Regarding the issues that licensee had with mother, there's a through line here. The board staff didn't directly take this on, but there's no requirement under Arizona law that you get consent from both parents. Your colleagues over at Psych Board have attempted a few times to clarify the law so that we can actually understand who is supposed to be able to sign off on minor clients being able to receive care. The law does not stand for the idea that both parents need to sign off. The example we always use is when you go to the dermatologist for your son, no dermatologist is going to sit down and read a parenting report from the court. And even so, dermatologist isn't part of the relationship. So the reality is that the law, it's not what the law says. It needs to be clarified. I would welcome legislation. We just don't have it. So we don't really know. There's no requirement, and therefore it's not the basis of sanctioning someone if someone treated with only one parent's consent. I do think she confused the difference between medical decision making versus release of records, and that has been corrected for her. She understands there is not necessarily always a complete overlap between when you can have the documents versus when you can actually make decisions about a child's care. And I think that was a gap in knowledge as opposed to anything with intent. And I do think that there are some mitigating factors here, including the fact that mom, when she called, wasn't using the same last name, wasn't clearly identifying who she was. She did demonstrate as well, thus far, she has still not sent in any kind of written request for records. So at this point, there just has not been a proper request made. And I don't know of an attorney who would advise a provider to send in records to another person potentially in violation of HIPAA without a written request. Concerning the suicidality issue, I want to push back on the IR. There's unchallenged evidence that licensee did a good job with this client, worked with the client on the self-harm issues. She didn't do it documented in the formalized way that I think we would want, and that's a documentation problem. She since implemented the PHQ-9, the ASK inventory. She's included documentation of screenings and screening risk. She also took classes on how to address suicidality and risk, how to work with children of divorce. Regarding the court advisor, I called the court advisor because it's a court advisor that I was familiar with. And she reports that she only reaches out to providers once she confirms that there's a release to call the providers. That was reported to the investigator as well. And I believe it's in the report. Let's talk about the forms and documentation. I'm not going to sit here and tell you the forms and documentation were good. But I think it's sort of a, this forms issue has permeated this case. We didn't have a conflict, but you were concerned about the conflict because the forms weren't great. We didn't have a real suicidality risk because she did proper care of this client. She didn't document it as well as she could have. There were some concerns about the court-appointed advisor reaching out to her but not charting that. That's not a failure of her to under the subsection of the ACA that says you're supposed to talk to other providers. What it is a failure to document. And so I think what the problem here is this is overall that permeates this case is really more of a documentation problem. And I want to talk to you about what she's done. She's fixed all of her forms, and she did that before she hired us. So she's done the work. She's actually had to sit with her forms and revise them. And board staff has indicated they are now compliant. She's hired an assistant who can actually work with her on processing calls, ensuring that everything is responded to in a timely manner, which takes some of the administrative burden off of her. And I think she understands now through this process the need for more defensible and risk management oriented charting, going so far as to bring on that office staff member. I don't disagree with the documentation problem here, but I do think that there are a lot of items that were raised that are that the impression is that there was a failure in the treatment when I think really what happened here or a failure in the communication when it really was is a failure of the documentation. So we're asking the board to think about where do we correct this? And I want the board to think about, despite the breadth of the allegations, is the through line here the documentation? And if you believe it's the documentation, I'd like the board to think about, is there an educational outcome here instead of a disciplinary outcome that would allow us to get to the same place? So I think I've covered all of the allegations. She is present. She's able to answer any of your questions. But I do think that the through line here was there were some practice breakdowns as opposed to necessarily some counseling breakdowns. Thank you.
Thank you. Any board members have any questions for the licensee?
I'd like to start with one.
Okay.
Could you tell us about how much training you've had in family therapy prior to this complaint?
A lot. I've been in practice for a long time, not just independently licensed before when I was an associate license. My primary role was as a family therapist with children and families with Native American connections. That goes back to 2011 when I started there. And then from there, I've moved into roles where I ran Guiding Star Residential Treatment, which was moms with their dependent children. Along that lines, from 2010 up until now, I would say I've had to do a lot of child and family trainings. When I was the assistant director of social services for the Salt River, Pima, Maricopa Indian community, I was there 7 years as the assistant director. We had consistent quarterly trainings we would do on working with conflict cases with parents and children. And in CPS care, as you're aware, those are very high conflict cases. So I feel comfortable working with those families due to my past experience. I started before I was a therapist as a behavior coach, behavior health technician in home with kids with severely mental illness. They would be CPS cases half the time, and I would be helping the parents with their children. So it's something I felt very comfortable with.
Okay, thank you.
I do have a couple of questions. Can you speak to the statement of client's file was connected to the father's file? No?
Okay. Maybe because
so the charts, my understanding was like the charts were kind of.
No, okay. The charts, I think maybe that is if I had communication with father around the client, it would go in the client's, like the note would go in client's file, not the father's file.
Okay.
I think maybe that's what that is. But my notes for each client are separate in my system. And I use an electronic medical record system, Theranos.
Okay, thank you. I have another question. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about based on, you know, your experience and then the trainings that you have taken recently, could you speak a little bit about your insight regarding how you would address a similar situation?
Yes. First, I would say personally, my eyes were a little opened. In all my years of being a therapist in conflict cases, this is the first request I've ever had for records. Most parents have always agreed not to request them on the basis of client care and treatment. They usually agree not to request them because then the client won't be honest and we won't be able to move forward therapeutically very well. And taking trainings more recently, they discuss more clearly and guidance on how to release those records accordingly, the time frame that should happen, and also personally being aware more of the legal pieces that I wasn't. My lay perspective and understanding was not good enough at that time, and now it's better having legal people read the documents and explain to me the difference between like the medical decision making and documentation release, and how to do that in a more timely and professional manner. But I was personally surprised because I was like, oh, I think I understand what I'm reading. And obviously I didn't have very clear understanding in a legal way. So.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah, I'm after. There's a few things here, but the one I'm having the biggest struggle with is the failing to assess the suicide risk with respect to the confidentiality and that sort of thing. Can you kind of walk through how that failed to get documented or what, how you arrived at your position that you felt comfortable?
So when I, prior to having all of the documents built into my system, I would go through the same questions. I would ask, you know, do you have current intent? Do you have means? When is the last time you felt suicidal? Do you currently feel suicidal? And those would be all the questions I would go through. Now my system does allow me to put in there like intent, no intent, present, things like that. And that is always documented in every single note, which means every time with every client I see, I'm always assessing. There's never a time I'm not assessing for suicidality, especially in teenage females because of the heightened risk at this moment in time with social media and everything. So that is something I would have done every single time with a client. And from my past experience, it is very common for teenage girls to use cutting as a tool to deal with stress, not necessarily meaning they want to unalive themselves. It's the best way I would like to say that. So I would go through those questions, which are part of the PHQ-9. They are part of the ASK as well. I just didn't have a formal assessment built into my system, which I do now, so that every time I do have a client that states they have some suicidality, I'm using those tools to support what it says in my notes, saying that I feel there's no risk of suicide. Whereas I think that was the major issue previously, is I didn't have those kind of documents and tools that are approved to show that the client didn't have those thoughts.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you. Now, this is going to be the time for us to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And we have Ms. Palacios, you're leading this discussion.
Yes, thank you. So, members of the board, I think there's a lot to discuss here. And I don't know if this is the place, but there's a statement made of parents signing documentation, both parents signing off. And so just wanting to get some clarity for the public so that the public and so licensees know, do we legally, what do both parents need to sign off? If both parents have medical decision-making, my understanding is that they both do. Anybody else have?
That there's even a question is kind of frustrating.
Right. So both parents do need to sign off to consent to treat, correct? I don't know if this is the place to bring it up, but I just wanted to have some clarity for.
Diane, I haven't seen it either, but I know in our family training, mm-hmm. we are always encouraged best practice is mm-hmm. to get both parents to sign off because mm-hmm. at any given time, just the same, a parent can decide that can withhold.
Right.
And then how would we decide? And we don't have the right to decide one or the other.
Correct.
And the rule of thumb, best practice, is if one parent is not in agreement, we do not provide treatment.
Yeah, we cannot treat.
Because it puts the parents in an adversarial place, and then we are adding to the conflict in this family. Mm-hmm. So if they are not in agreement, right, mm-hmm. Also, we're not going to have good therapy. If any parent has the parental right to that child, they have the right to be included. They have the right to be updated. They have the right to that. Even if they're not making the final decision, mm-hmm. they have the right to be participating in that if they have parenting rights.
Right.
So that's why I asked about the training, because that is what we get in our training very consistently, mm-hmm. is that is the avenue we go, since it is a little bit unclear.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for having this discussion. I just wanted to make it clear for licensees in public. Another thing is that I was thinking of is with documentation and forms, and if something's not documented, it's looked at as it didn't happen. And so even though there are documentation issues, it's more to that, is we're not giving a good clinical picture of what happened when the suicidality wasn't clearly documented. And so so that's more of that's a concern, not just, putting it under the umbrella of it's a documentation issue. It's a clinical issue too. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing that stood out to me in hearing the complaint and hearing the licensee today is just something else to address. So I'm prepared to make some motions, but I want to hear from the rest of my colleagues on any other thoughts that they have.
I just have a comment on the issue that you just talked about. There's so many things that need to be documented, and I think that we need to consider the efforts that the licensee has made to have adequate prompts mm-hmm. on her documentation to, decrease the chance that something like this could happen again. And that's why, we have to be very careful with electronic health records to make sure that they have what we need, because there's so many things that need to be, clearly documented, that to just try to keep them in your head is difficult. So the prompts are to consider that.
Right. And I do agree. I think the licensee has made steps, taken CEUs, has updated the EHR, her record, her medical keeping system, and has the appropriate assessments now. And so I think looking at that as well is that those steps have been made. But I still feel like that it would be important to fine for violations.
I just wanted to really quickly, before you make a motion, and this kind of falls in line with both you are saying, is that I don't buy the argument that my EHR's limitations prevented me from documenting appropriately. I just want to go on record for licensees in the room or listening. It's not an excuse. It's not an excuse to say that my EHR doesn't have the necessary mechanisms that allow me to document suicidality or homicidality. So I think it's best practice to look outside of your EHR and to look at what you're trained to do. You're trained to document clearly client risk, what you do to assess that risk, and what you do to ensure that that risk doesn't become an actual concern. So I just want to go on record and say, I've heard that before, but, our training tells us to do more. So just do better.
And the board's now putting out cheat sheets for different documents of what is needed. And so it's pretty clear on the board, the Facebook pages that the board has. And so something I think, too, is for folks that are going from agency work, whereas the agency most likely has all of the proper forms, and then going into private practice and not realizing these forms in private practice may or may not fit all of the board requirements. And so when going into private practice, it's really the licensee's responsibility to ensure that every single form is meeting the documentation requirements and board requirements. So.
Can I speak for a minute just on multiple clients as an MFT? I just want to make sure that's addressed. I respect the position today that, yes, if we read that strictly, that you are never to ever see anybody else in the family, we would never have any family therapy happen. And a lot of good therapy happens when we have some relationships with the parents, some relationships with the kids, some relationships with them as a family. We just need to be really careful how we document, how we treatment plan what we're doing. Where I have a problem in this particular case is that we have a parent that does have parenting rights that has not been included. So it does, on the face of, you know, on its face, it looks like we have an alignment with a father, an alignment with a child, and we have an estranged additional parent. Not every parent participates, but we have no documentation that says there was any effort made. And that's all I would have needed to see. But since that didn't occur, then it does look like we have an over-alignment, which we try really hard to have neutral relationships for the benefit of family change and progress. Right. So I just wanted to kind of talk about, like, yes, I don't think that on its face, the issue of just treating multiple family members is in essence the issue. It's how this was done, which makes treating multiple family members not in the spirit of benefit for the family growth, including all family members.
Yeah. Okay. Madam Chair, may I add something? I was going to say it earlier, but I couldn't remember the statute, so I didn't want to just say it without saying the statute, because I just want to be clear, the board's position has always been that in the state of Arizona, only one parent legally is required to consent to treat. However, when I present, I always remind them best practices to get both, mm-hmm. because when the second parent that didn't consent decides they don't want you treating their kiddo, then you have to quit. And so that's really important. But I do want to read this out loud for the record. It's ARS 362272. Except as otherwise provided by law or a court of order, no person, corporation, association, organization, or state-supported institution or any individual employed by any of these entities may procure, solicit, to perform, arrange for the performance of or perform mental health screening in a non-clinical setting or mental health treatment on a minor without first obtaining the written or oral consent of a parent or a legal custodian of the minor child. If the parental consent is given through telehealth, the health professional must verify parent's identity as a site where the consent is given. So I do want to state that on the record. I think that's important information for our members to have as well as the public. But I also kind of want to reiterate that was not part of our analysis. Our analysis is in regard to the Code of Ethics B5B, and that's pretty much what Dr. Bailey has just mentioned, mm-hmm. and that talks about the role of involving them. So I just want to be clear, we're not suggesting that they're violating this law. It's just that the way it went down the path of therapy, and that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, so can I pull that together just a minute?
Please.
So again, it leads us to best practice that we want to get both parents when we don't have an intact household, that they're both on the same page so that we don't have this happen, right? We don't have midway through therapy something happen. So I think the idea, I'm okay with some of the language. I think we need the added piece of when we have two separate entities of a family. I think that language speaks to maybe a household of two biological parents living under the same roof, and we hope they talk.
Right.
But if we don't do that extra step, this is an open door to happen often.
Right, and then disruption of treatment.
Absolutely.
Lack of continuity of care.
Absolutely. Good point.
Yeah.
Thank you for that moment.
Yeah. So I'm prepared to make a motion to find for violation, failing to release medical records, ARS 3232516KK, as well as the conflict of interest, ARS 3232516K, A8, multiple clients, B5B, responsibility to parents and legal guardians, as well as failing to adequately assess suicide risk, ARS 3232516L, documentation deficiencies, ARS 3232516P.
As it relates to 1101, 1102, 1103, 1104, 1105, and 1106.
That is correct.
Ms. Palacios, can I'm in agreement with the motion, but I feel like I need to go on record just to talk about for a moment, not to belabor our meeting, but the idea of a client. I want to respect the idea that if we have a parent calling in saying that there's somebody and it feels not right, there's something wrong, I do think it's our obligation to not just immediately call that person back and assume it's the person they say. For our telehealth rules, we have to have some sort of identifying information if they're on the phone that we're talking to the person we think we're talking to. And so I just wanted to go on record saying that I do feel like I can understand why the complaint, why the licensee did not call this mom back. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we also, if this is the mom, right, if this is the appropriate person, they need to know how to do something. And this parent might not have known what that they need to do anything in writing because she doesn't have any consent forms.
Right.
So how do we make calls back? How do we give information in case it is the right person that still is doesn't give a lot of, you know, PHI?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make the ultimate assumption it's the right person, but we do say if there was something you wanted to request, this is the route you go, and at least we give the information on the possibility that we actually are talking to the right person.
Right, right.
So I didn't want that to get not addressed, and I don't want licensees to think that if anyone calls, we just call them back and assume they're the person.
Right.
We do need to have some due diligence so that we feel comfortable that reasonably we did the right thing with the information we were given.
Right, and I believe that's in the consent form or telehealth consent form of being able to identify any type of electronic communication that is not face-to-face.
Right.
And so minimum would be providing a phone number, providing your name, providing some identifying information.
Or at least the directions to, you know, how to go about how we would normally then scrutinize whatever the information is that we got. If we got something that was in writing, we might be able to look at that differently.
Right.
But I just wanted to address that piece so that we don't move forward thinking that anybody calling in, we just immediately.
Right, right.
And I think that part was done well. We just didn't do any second part. We just avoided the whole issue.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And friendly reminder, if you're dealing with a novel issue like this that you have not encountered before, you can always call the board if you're feeling stumped and you don't know what the next right new move to do. That would have been a good time to call and ask.
Or consult somebody.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Consult, ethical decision tree making, all of those options.
Sorry, just to not to put you on the spot and to belabor the point, but then are you suggesting that the right response would have been not to divulge private information, but just call back and say, hey, this is the route you need to take?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm hearing a message that's saying you're requesting some information, requesting any type of information requires this route. And this is where you would go, and I would leave it at that, and then just see what we get in.
Okay.
And then see if it's valid, if it feels valid, if I need to consult somebody on it or whatnot. But just to not say anything, it wasn't done in the proper format. This person wouldn't even know what the proper format was because she was not included into knowing that. We can't expect the average person to know that you have to request that in writing.
Okay.
Without doing a lot of research. So.
Yeah. So is there still a pending motion?
That is still my motion.
Second, Kramer.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And do you have any recommendations?
I do. So the licensee's already done a bunch of CEUs, so I think I'd like to grandfather those into the consent agreement. But my initial thoughts were taking 6 CEUs on high conflict families, 6 CEUs on assessing suicide, 3 CEUs on documentation billing records, the CEUs on suicide crisis safety planning. Also, potentially attending a board meeting. And I also was thinking about supervision and practice monitor. It sounds like her documents currently are fitting board standards. So maybe an auditor, once every 6 months or so, if documentation meets board requirements, one audit and then another audit in 6 months from now.
So I'm sorry, initial and then 6 months?
Yes. And any thoughts? I would like to have some more discussion.
Quick question for you. Have you looked at it? It looks like the licensee did some type of CEUs on suicide assessment and intervention. Is that training not as, because I thought you said some additional training in that space.
Yeah.
Is the training taken not up to par or?
To grandfather in what she has to
Okay, pass. So ignore, so, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was my question. Did you mean like in addition to what she has taken?
Yeah, okay.
Like that it can count towards
okay.
What work, how we're developing the consent agreement. So what she has taken to include that can be included.
Okay.
And counted towards.
Do you guys think the audit, I mean, I know we don't always ask for an audit when there are documentation deficiencies. I'm just wondering if that feels more appropriate here because I don't know. I just wanted to kind of talk that out since that's an additional cost and I want to make sure it's appropriate.
I didn't necessarily see the need for that based on like previous cases. I noticed this one client. I didn't necessarily see the need for it, but.
What do the clinicians think?
I agree with you. Yeah. I don't see the need for.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
I don't get bothered with
it. Yeah. Okay. I'm willing to change that. That's my initial thoughts when I was reading through. So, yeah.
You could have the clinical supervisor do a random audit, which they should be anyways.
Right. Yeah.
You could put that inside as a focus.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems better.
That would feel, yeah, that might feel, that's more congruent.
So you mentioned supervision?
Mm-hmm. I would say maybe, so 2 years, potentially, but I would say potential for release after a year based upon the clinical supervisor's discretion and maybe the first 6 months every 2 weeks. And then after the first 6 months, monthly, and then kind of see where she's at with everything, focusing on documentation, on assessing families. And doing the caseload audit, or just the audit of documentation, audit of.
Yeah.
I'm debating on the two times every 2 weeks.
I'm
versus
with
monthly.
I am with monthly as well.
Monthly?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that would do an adequate job.
Monthly for 12 months and with the option of releasing after that.
Yeah. I think that's.
Okay. That works. Cover it.
Yeah. Up to the supervisor's discretion after the 12 months if it needs to continue or not, right?
And Ms. Zavala, would that be like a release from the consent agreement or the release just from the supervision? Or
being that it's education and clinical supervision, it could be from the entire consent agreement, but the clinical supervisor would only be making a recommendation to be released from the clinical supervision piece. And if she's completed all of the education, then they could ask for release.
Okay. Does that...
That works for me.
Yeah, that's my motion.
I have a few questions here.
Okay.
So let's go back in looking at the additional education that has been taken. Mm-hmm. It does appear that there were the 6 hours of the suicide assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Are any of those going to be acceptable for the 6 hours of high conflict court cases or the 3 hours of Arizona documentation? I would not think so, but just confirming with you.
I'm with you. I think that, okay, so she took 1 hour of treating a child from divorce, right? I think that maybe we need to have at least
let's say three. Six, and so she could apply the
yeah.
one.
So five more. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That area, recent training. Mm-hmm.
So we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required to take 6 CEUs in high conflict court cases, 6 CEUs in suicide assessment, 3 CEUs in Arizona documentation, and attend a board meeting for 5 CEUs. With that said, there will be a clause in there indicating that any CEUs that have been taken since the complaint or information that's been submitted today can be considered to meet the requirements of the education requirements. In addition to that, she will need to receive clinical supervision once monthly. The focus is going to be on Arizona documentation, board statutes and rules, assessment, high conflict court cases, and each quarter will need to have 3 records audited for documentation. At the end of that 12 months, at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, she can request release. And if not signed, she'll be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing. Is that your motion?
That is my motion.
Do we have a second?
Trotter, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. So this concludes this matter, and you're free to go. Ms. Oliver, you're free to hang up. And if you have any additional questions, you can reach out to your investigator next week. All right. Are we at a good time for a little break?
Yes.
How much do we need? 10 minutes. So we're breaking at 10:27. The board is back in session at 10:37. And I may remind board members to turn on your microphones. And I am going to move to item 7E, Timothy Mills. And this case has been tabled.
Okay.
Next item is 7A, Christine Carrillo. So is the complainant here? And licensee, Christine, and Ms. Holly Geisel. Yes. All right, so we're first going to listen to summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, the analysis is quite lengthy, so you're going to see me kind of jumping around a little bit to get the majority of the facts in. With that being said, all of the facts are part of the analysis. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation: ARS 3232516K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession as it relates to the following section of the ACA Code of Ethics, A6E, non-professional interactions or relationships. This recommendation is based on the following: from 621 to 322, licensee provided IOP behavioral health services to complainant at agency one. Shortly after complainant's graduation from agency one's IOP, licensee and complainant engaged in electronic communication outside of the therapeutic session. The electronic communications between licensee and complainant included the following in part: undated screenshots showing licensee and complainant were Facebook friends and that licensee followed complainant on Instagram. 3/13/22 email between complainant and licensee included the following: complainant stated she missed licensee and thanked licensee for letting her follow her on Instagram as it makes it easier for complainant emotionally being connected to licensee. Licensee responded that she would not have accepted complainant's request if she thought it was a boundary crossing. I'm going to read some following text messages without including the dates. Licensee text complainant that she will always hold a special place in licensee's heart. Licensee told complainant she was there for her and called complainant babe. Facebook post shows licensee commented sending love on complainant's post about her birthday. Text messages showing licensee asking how complainant was doing and complainant responded talking about school. Facebook post by complainant showing licensee liked the photo of complainant in a bikini. Undated text show licensee informing complainant she was moving into private practice and sent her Psychology Today profile. Additional undated texts show licensees stating she wishes she could be more of a support and would be going into private practice in 4 to 6 months so they can discuss starting individual therapy again. A text message included licensee asking a complainant was okay and licensee was thinking about complainant. Complainant sent a picture of chips to licensee and licensee responded, "You love your hot chips." Complainant stated she thought licensee loved and cared about her. Text from licensee to complainant indicated licensee was sorry complainant was having panic attacks, but they both knew it was not a result of anything licensee did or said. Text show complainant stating she was really sad and felt like nothing, and licensee responds she can only recommend a higher level of care to complainant. Undated text messages show licensee apologizing to complainant, stating she cares deeply for complainant and complainant's well-being. Undated text show licensee stating her and complainant worked together for a long time, and of course there was going to be human emotions, but complainant needs a therapist with stronger boundaries. Undated text show licensee asking if complainant's therapist reported licensee, and licensee hoped complainant got it cleared up. Undated text messages show licensee stating complainant blurred the lines of their relationship, and licensee has all the texts and emails showing complainant's inappropriate behaviors and borderline tendencies. Despite a 225-22 progress note completed by licensee at agency one documenting that the complainant had grown very attached to licensee failed to set boundaries with complainant at the conclusion of services at agency one and inappropriately engaged in non-therapeutic conversations with complainant for several months. Additionally, after complainant's discharge from agency one, licensee almost immediately began having contact with complainant outside of the therapy setting and failed to document anywhere her ethical decision-making model or rationale for continuing contact with complainant. Even more concerning, if the texts appear to be wholly unprofessional, where licensee calls complainant babe and tells complainant that she will always have a special place in licensee's heart. Licensee then begins telling complainant she would be going into private practice and would start services again with complainant, showing that licensee was aware complainant was in need of behavioral health services. Even more concerning is that some of the texts licensee sends have undertones of blame shifting, as if to blame complainant and put various responsibilities on complainant. This is evidenced by texts where licensee states that the panic attacks complainant was experiencing was not a result of the licensee did, and another text where licensee tells complainant she needs to clear things up regarding whether her therapist reported licensee. It is highly concerning that licensee was fully aware of the unhealthy attachment complainant had towards licensee, yet licensee chose to engage in texting, email, and social media contact following the termination of complainant's services at Agency 1. From 123 to 223, licensee provided behavioral services to complainant at Agency 2. At the onset of these services, licensee failed to document anywhere within the clinical records her prior therapeutic and non-therapeutic relationship with complainant and how licensee would be able to remain objective in complainant's treatment. It is concerning that licensee chose to initiate services again with complainant, even after complainant expressed her attachment and love for licensee. Licensee acknowledged not establishing clear boundaries with complainant upon terminations of services at Agency 1 and agrees it is not appropriate to converse with a client following the termination of services because it could create codependency. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be the following violation, ARS 3230-51-16L, as it relates to failing to adequately assess suicide. This recommendation is based on the following. From 621 to 322, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant at Agency 1. During the course of treatment at Agency 1, complainant had disclosed suicidal ideation during sessions. A 10-1-21 note included the following. Complainant states sometimes she wants to die. Complainant gets so upset she feels like suicide is the answer. Complainant reported not being suicidal or having a plan or intent, but when things are out of control, she has negative thoughts about suicide. A 10-21 note indicated complainant was experiencing suicide ideation. A 12-2-21 note including the following. Complainant has been struggling with her emotions. Complainant had thoughts of self-harm and became suicidal because her mother would not stop engaging with her. Despite at least three progress notes documenting complainant had suicidal ideation, licensee failed to develop any sort of safety plan or complete a risk assessment to assess complainant's suicide. It is highly concerning that licensee represents safety planning as a common part of her practice, yet failed to complete any sort of a safety plan with complainant despite several disclosures of suicide ideation. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support ARS 16S, failing to ensure continuity of care. This recommendation is based on the following. From 621-322, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant at Agency 1 until her discharge from the program. From 123 to 223, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant at Agency 2. A 128-23, licensee completed a biopsychosocial assessment with complainant at the onset of services at Agency 2. On 128-23, licensee completed a treatment plan with complainant, which indicated the estimated completion of treatment would be 3 months and treatment frequency would be every 2 weeks. Licensee in turns has one session with complainant on 2/11/23, where the note indicates they review DBT and will create a trauma timeline to pick up targets for neuroprocessing. A 2/11/23 licensee enters a note indicating licensee and complainant will terminate treatment due to safety concerns pertaining to the therapeutic alliance. A 2/17/23 contact note indicated licensee and complainant discussed the termination of services based on complainant's inability to maintain confidentiality and adhere to HIPAA. A 2/18/23 note indicated services were discontinued due to a mutual decision since complainant was sharing information with her mother and the mother reached out to licensee leaving threatening messages. Nowhere within the clinical record does it indicate licensee took any steps to ensure continuity of care for complainant. Despite licensee documenting there was a conversation around the termination of services, licensee acknowledged that complainant wanted to remain in services, yet licensee terminated the therapeutic service anyway. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be a violation of ARS 3232516P as it relates to documentation deficiencies, ARS R461101, 1102, and 1106. This recommendation is based on the following. From 621 to 322, licensee provided services for complainant at Agency 1. The informed consent signed at Agency 1 failed to include three elements. The progress notes at Agency 1 failed to include two telehealth elements. From 123 to 223, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant at Agency 2. That informed consent failed to include three elements. On 128-23, treatment plan completed Agency 2. That failed to include two elements. It is concerning that licensee failed to ensure clinical documentation she was utilizing included all minimum board requirements. Furthermore, in 2020 and 2022, licensee submitted her LAC renewal applications with the board, where she was required to complete the Arizona Statutes Regulations tutorial, which provides education and training on Arizona clinical documentation standards. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have any questions? No? Okay, thank you. Thanks. So, Ms. Carrillo, you have up to, both of you have up to 10 minutes to address the board. Okay. I think your microphone is off.
Oh, it's
there
back.
You go.
Thank you.
All right.
First of all, I want to thank you for a very detailed and thorough summary and factual summary. It makes it easier to respond. Clearly, there are some deficiencies in what the board has identified. My client was at the time this, she saw the complainant, a 14-month licensed professional here in Arizona. So she's a young practitioner. She was working at two agencies, and I think that two providers, agency one, agency two. And I think that a valuable lesson that she has learned and that all licensees can learn from this case at the start is that you cannot rely on the documents that your employing agency has, the consent to treat, the electronic medical record. It was one of the first things that we discussed. It's a hard lesson for lawyers. If you're a lawyer in a great big firm, you assume that your firm has the right documents. You can't do that. So that's the first thing. She acknowledges those documentation deficiencies. We had a long conversation where she said, I thought I was doing it right. I know I wasn't. I will change the way I do things, have my own forms, and make sure that they are correct. So I think this is a real service to her and a real lesson to licensees. In that regard, there are, in fact, a lot of things in this case that could be a case study for people in training, in school, and in practice early on. I think going through just point by point, there is no dispute that the boundaries here got out of control. And once out of control, as happens when you lose that boundary, they tend to escalate, or like a wave, the wave tends to get bigger. She acknowledges that. She understands exactly the communications that she shouldn't have had, when she should have stopped, what she should have done. And your report in a case study would instruct a student or another young practitioner exactly what to do. This is a roadmap for what can go wrong. Moving on, the failing to address adequately the suicidality, I think my client saw this as an opportunity to learn, and that's how she soaked it all in. And she acknowledges that she could have done a better job. As her attorney, I believe there was, in fact, an adequate assessment of the suicidality as reflected in the notes. The statements are made. You take those in the context. You inquire about the statements. It requires more than just negative thoughts unhappiness and desperateness. There was no plan or intent. So I believe that that is an area where there may be, in fact, some lack of clarity. We all know that predicting suicide, even with the best risk assessment available, is quite difficult. But one of the key points that you always look at is the intent there, and has that intent manifested itself in a plan? So I think that was there. Additionally, again, as we heard in the first case, Theranote, which is the EMR that was in place at the agency, does not give you a place to record a safety plan. We discussed it.
We created them on paper.
That's it.
And EDOC would take them.
Exactly. But again, the fact that you're this nationally known, widely used software, EMR, doesn't let you put it there, doesn't diminish your responsibility to be sure that you have addressed that issue of a safety plan and that as need be, you've created it. And they wrote it on paper and dealt with it. But that's a deficiency in the EMR. I don't know if it's the same EMR that the prior licensee was dealing with, but that's another thing that the licensees can learn from. The failing to ensure continuity of care, I think it's important to know that after the termination of the therapeutic relationship, the client already had a new therapist and was engaged in that therapist, with that therapist. That therapist was at a major behavioral health clinic in Arizona, one of the largest. So the continuity of care was in place at the time the relationship was terminated. The documentation deficiencies we have discussed, and I, at both agencies, this licensee, and I hope all licensees can learn from this, we need a journal article about it. You can't rely on your employer's documentation. You are the therapist. It's your documentation, and you've got to do it. I mention all of this because this is a client where I think it's an excellent example of how numerous areas of concern are ripe for education, for maybe additional supervision, but should not be disciplinary in nature. And that's what I would ask you to consider. I finally want to note, I don't think we have time, but the client and I went through the complainants list of grievances and allegations, and at least 70% of them are inaccurate or blatantly false and highly manipulative. I'm not going to criticize the client any more than I would criticize one of my clients, but we have to keep in mind that this client was a chronic abuser of clonopin, marijuana, and alcohol. Her diagnoses were delusional disorder, borderline personality disorder, and histrionic personality. Now, hopefully, this licensee and others will, when they see those diagnoses, every antenna that you possess is going to go up, and you are going to understand the danger that these mental illnesses present for the client and for you. And the term that I think Flynn used earlier was risk management, complaint, boundaries. That's what this client should signal to everybody. But when she says that something is posted on Facebook, a sexual photo of the licensee with her leg wrapped around her friend, that is simply false. It's a photo of colleagues, female, with their arms around each other posing for a picture. Now, if licensees can get in trouble for that, we need to really put out an Arizona Republic front page article. Most of what is here is typical of the mental health struggle that this individual had, but it is untrue, which is a feature of those diagnoses, and as I said, should cause your licensee to have all of the bells and whistles going on. So thank you very much. I hope you will consider the circumstances, consider the acceptance of responsibility, and permit this licensee to have education and supervision. Thank you.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for the licensee or her attorney?
I have a few we can start with. I have quite a few written down, but one that just came to mind as I'm listening, what I feel like I'm hearing is opening the door for also working out of scope. If I listen to what is being presented, it's we have these disorders. Normally, we should then have our radar up because what happened throughout the course of treatment absolutely is not indicated, right, for good treatment of those disorders. And so did we take on a client that you absolutely knew had these kinds of symptoms and then still behaved this way?
Yes, ma'am. At the time, I was running an IOP, so it was in a group setting. And so agency work, I don't get to choose my clients. We were primarily access clients. We can't turn anyone away. There was two therapists that were working with her and a dietitian, so we did have a team. So at the time, I had more support when she was in IOP. However, you're absolutely correct. I should not have taken her back on into private practice considering, you know, the extreme behavioral patterns, and I allowed it to get out of control, and I hold myself accountable.
The other question I think I have is kind of related to the suicidality piece. I think in the materials I read pretty clearly that your statement was, I wouldn't have responded to the client's text messages if you had not feared the complainant would hurt herself or anyone else. So This kind of feels, as I'm reading that, it kind of feels like we absolutely recognize this was a suicidal client, which also misguided you to behave in a way that might have also perpetuated that.
I guess I had a lot of fear towards her, fear of her hurting others or herself. And once again, I allowed it to get out of control. I did the wrong thing. I should have consulted. So that, again, is on me.
I have wanted to know, is it normal practice? Let me rephrase that. Do you watch your phone and manage incoming messages while you're in session with your clients?
At times, yes. If I continuously get phone call after phone call, I'll press the send to voicemail button.
While you're in a session with someone else?
No. Well, if it keeps going off, yes. Like, I'll press the reject button.
And today, do you still think that's a good practice?
If my phone, like, went off and to stop it from ringing, is that what you mean? I'm sorry. No, it should be. It's on do not disturb.
Okay. But it was not, and you were attending to that. Because you made a comment. You actually text back this client, I can't talk now. I'm in session.
I wasn't in session. It was just a deflection, right?
But it would indicate that you would think that that was okay.
No, I don't think that's okay. Right? Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't understand the question.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll defer to my colleagues.
I just have one question. So you mentioned that that you always had good boundaries and now they're stronger. Can you speak to, you know, how are they stronger now?
Continued education, evaluating, you know, looking at this complaint, reading through it, just evaluating my behavior, what I could have done differently. I've learned a lot from this. It has been a humbling experience. It's been, you know, traumatic for both parties. I understand that. I acknowledge it. But I think I've learned a really deep, hard lesson from all of this.
Mm-hmm. What might be a stronger boundary that you have now?
In one way, like, I would never respond to any text messages outside of therapy. That would be number one. Ever allow any kind of conversations via email or through social media. Those are huge boundary violations, and I acknowledge that.
Thank you. Any other questions for the licensee? Yes.
Not necessarily a question, just, and I don't know how important it is, a clarification, pointing to page 137 for you for the photo. I don't know that it's necessary, but your description of the photo on page 137 is a little different than my interpretation, but for the record.
My pages aren't numbered, but I won't quibble with our interpretations, and I respect your, that's the problem with photos, isn't it? When you don't know how and when and all they were taken, they can be taken easily out of context. Sure.
Can I follow up with another question that I just found?
Yeah.
We have a character statement in, you have a nurse practitioner, nurse colleague that you obviously worked with or somewhat because you have her value of your character.
My dietitian that I was working with at the time.
And embedded in that character gouging, if you will. It also talks about you seeing her daughter. And I'm just wondering if today, is that something you were even contemplating, was seeing her daughter, if her daughter was agreeable? Because it insinuates that she's the one resistant. She hopes that her daughter changes her mind and comes to see you.
I'm not sure what character letter. Is it my dietitian, Christina?
It's an RN. I didn't write her name. I just...
Oh, no, I would never see... That's duality. I would never see her daughter.
Okay, so I hope after today, like, we addressed that, so it doesn't seem like,
yes,
you know, ma'am. You would be more than willing and or open the door to have a very then uncomfortable ma'am. Conversation.
It was just her being complimentary, but no, I would never engage in that kind of relationship because I had worked with her.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I do have one. I can't find it, but I had thought I had seen somewhere that the complainant you believed was under the influence during sessions. Was that somewhere in here?
No, not during our session.
Not during
but
sessions.
In between
okay.
sessions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
If I may, there's only one last thing. The behavioral health community lost a wonderful psychiatrist a few years ago to a homicide by a disgruntled family member. Number 82 here, factual finding number 82, was that this complainant told the licensee that her mom... number 84, that the mom had called, she had spoken to her mother out of context. That is absolutely false, but what I want the board to know is that the mother called, threatening the client that she was going to, quote, beat the S out of her because, as a result of the therapy, the complainant had reported her sister to DCS because she was being sexually abused by the sister's boyfriend. There were other threats made. I think I mention it only because I don't know that if the board will hear from these parties again, but I am very concerned. When we first talked, I had a long conversation with her about what she must do when those kinds of things occur, how to protect herself, how to protect the practice, et cetera. And I think the response there was very, very positive. I just wanted to alert the board to this. We don't want to lose another provider.
Thank you.
And again, okay. I think that goes to support why the boundaries are so important and why
Absolutely.
Abiding by the rules are so important to do the best
Absolutely.
Job we can do. But to do better.
And I think an experienced, I had this situation as a young lawyer dealing with very dangerous criminal clients. My response then was almost, do you feel guilty? You want to try to placate? My response now is, nope, we have a different way to deal with that. And I think that is another kind of lesson here. And she acknowledged it just wonderfully, openly.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So no further questions. Now this is the time for the board members to deliberate. And I believe, Dr. Bailey, you're leading the discussion.
Yeah, I think in light of our conversation, I think in light of the material and the conversation today, I think it's absolutely warrants finding for all the violations. I think we have ample evidence, very clear and convincing that these things occurred. You know, that we absolutely had unprofessional boundaries. We've admitted the documentation deficiencies. I think I'm uncomfortable with the idea that we did the not being able to assess suicidality. I don't know any EHR that doesn't have an upload somewhere, right? It might not look clean and it might be seven screens down from the record, but we have ways. So and then we have an acknowledgement that we actually acted in behavior incongruent to what we would normally do for fear of that. So why did we not take other steps? We didn't consult anyone. We didn't ask anyone. We didn't, even out of fear, right? If I was in such a mess, I think I'd be like, I need the word help, right, kind of mm-hmm. starts, and we didn't have any of that either. So I do think we failed to address that appropriately, even if we want to take the testimony today and believe that something did happen, it did not happen well. So I don't think I could not find for that. The continuity of care issue feels like that happened in several situations. So even though we heard today that she was in a site, there's still no documentation that for a person this symptomatic, from what we're hearing today, mm-hmm. if we are going to say it was a person that's asymptomatic, we would want to do a lot better job of making sure that the person had adequate care, especially if we're also worried about hurting someone else, if we're worried about all these things. So the more information that happens today makes me also think that this violation is more appropriate than maybe even what I originally read through.
Yeah, just thinking about the vulnerability of the client, and
I would agree.
Any other further discussion?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I mean, you know, we had a significant record. You know, we heard from one person today. I just, you know, that a client has significant substance use issues or mental illness is not a mitigating factor, you know, for licensees. That's the job. And the fact that their diagnoses are complex makes it even more important that the ethical rules are getting followed. And I just want everyone to hear that, you know, that these are complex clients does not make your job, you know, that doesn't give you an excuse for not following some of these rules. It makes it more important. So I just want to say that out loud.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had some of the same thoughts of that as well.
Just in line with Ms. Kramer, I just have to go on record. You know what? I think what's bothering me the most about what I'm reading here, and with all due respect to the council, I think that a lot of people make a mistake at defining your client by their diagnosis. Because mm-hmm. what I heard was, if you've got a psychotic, if you've got a borderline, then you know how they are, right? No, you don't. You don't. Because psychosis, borderline personality disorder, is different for every individual. Mm-hmm. So when I read in here about safety planning, I see things like, oh, you know, it's attention seeking, it's whatever it might be. But what that tells me is that there's a lack of clinical oversight or clinical insight mm-hmm. that is allowing bias and preconception to change what you do for that client. I just want to go on record and say, clinicians, be careful of that. You know, don't look at someone's intake and say, here goes another psychotic. Mm-hmm. Like, go into it and say, what does this individual person need? Mm-hmm. The other comment I want to make about when you're in an agency setting and you're assigned a client and you have no control over who you get, you do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go on record and say that because it's your responsibility to review their intake, to review their assessment, and to determine if your scope of practice matches their needs. And if it doesn't, it's your responsibility and obligation to talk to that supervisor and say, this person is not appropriate to be in my care or in my group. So there's no excuse for, I was assigned that client and I have no choice. It's still your obligation and responsibility to protect that client and to protect your scope of practice. So,
my comment was going to be about possible, you know, I have written the same, you know, referring to a patient or client with suicidal ideation as attention seeking is very concerning to me, as well as stating that the client failed a suicide attempt. You know, those kind of terms indicate to me that there's a need for, you know, substantial training, you know, on this kind of presentation so that you're better equipped, right? So the stance that you take on how you view the person, right, affects how you treat them. So, yeah, I think there's, just saying the same thing. You ready to make a motion?
I am. I do move that we fine for the violations of unprofessional boundaries with the client, 32, 32, 51, 16K. as well as failing to adequately assess suicidality, 32-32-51-16L. Failing to ensure continuity of care, 32-32-51-16S, as well as documentation deficiencies, 32-32-51-16P, as it relates to R461-101, 1102, and 1106.
Do we have a second?
Second, Kramer.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Do you have recommendations?
Yeah. So what came, what kind of set with me difficultly, that's really not grammatically correct, but was we have kind of a little bit of an argument of newly licensed, but then in my head, I'm like, okay, but then we have an extra ethics class that was probably a year ago, right? So it feels to me like when we have newly licensed, yes, they misstep. They also ask a lot of questions usually because, right? So we're, and we have all of it missing. So all of the information missing and reaching out then when we become newly licensed. So I don't know how much sunk in is what is bothering me that we had so many missteps. I mean, in every category of clinical care, we had a misstep. Not just one, it was literally everywhere. I mean, even just giving out our social media, you know, accepting a request, that is everywhere that we don't do that for these reasons, right? We can misinterpret messages and then actually this was being used. So I think a very strict consent agreement, if we're going to give one, wasn't feeling so great about a consent agreement when I started. I'll just be transparent about that. So it leads me then to, if we are going to offer one, I would like it to be very strict. I think 2 years with no release. We can, you know, tack on the education here in a minute, but I think supervision for that time, I think twice a month, every other week for the first year, and get back on track with what's expected and what the rules mean. If we've read them, it didn't seem like they were applied or mm-hmm. acknowledged much, in this case at least. Hopefully there's not others. So supervision. The education I think I'd like to see is, I'm thinking a grad class in ethics, only because I started off in the position I let you know that I wasn't quite sure what happened in ethics there to begin with. So maybe the grad class in ethics, 6 units on suicidality and risk assessment, 6 units on documentation. I'd even add in there maybe, you know, 3 units on discharge planning and, you know, transferring care, continuity of care. That might be covered elsewhere, but I think if we can find something that specifically says that, then it'd be really honed in on, and 3 units probably would be adequate on that. Mm-hmm. What was the other? Any other ideas?
I guess the like dual relationship and like mm-hmm. text messaging and all of that's going to be covered in the grad ethics class, or
it should be.
I went that route, hoping mm-hmm. boundaries, dual relationships, mm-hmm. even some documentation, but I think we do need to add specific documentation yeah. requirements, especially because it sounds like she was entertaining or did go into private practice, probably entertaining that for future.
If I may interrupt you, Dr. Bailey, I think that sometimes we forget to consider or look at or, you know, be conscious of the possible negative effect to the client when we engage in, you know, dual relationship or outside of the therapeutic. But I don't know if that is something that's addressed in any course necessarily. Maybe the ethics or kind of dual relationship.
I feel like that part is acknowledged only so that we understand why we have that rule.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, we hope it's built into all the ethics classes. I feel like that's built into the curriculum around dual relationships and unprofessional relationships.
Unprofessional.
Why? Okay. Because even the code of ethics that are kind of loose, I know ACE is a little bit loose on relationships after you terminate. Mm-hmm. I feel like most programs still talk about, you know, one, we still have, you can't gauge how that's not going to negatively impact the client. What are you going to do when the client wants therapy later, right? Now, do you say, oh no, now we're friends and now we can't, mm-hmm. and yet I've already done therapy with you. So even though it's loosely worded, it just feels like I can't think of a time when that would actually work.
No.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
It's never the client's fault when there is a dual relationship or mm-hmm. and on professional relationship, regardless of how complex their diagnosis is.
Right. That power okay. differential. Yeah. I was also going to maybe suggest adding attending a board meeting.
I agree. Absolutely. I would actually say two in the scope of 2 years, the kind of cases that come before. I think every board meeting is rich in its own right. So mm-hmm. two, I think, would cover a lot of different things that we see.
Yeah.
Okay. And just to sort of flesh out, because you probably haven't been to a lot of board meetings, but just to appreciate the weight, when Dr. Bailey says, you know, was considering the possibility of not offering a consent agreement, the alternative is revocation. So it's very serious, and I think that just shows the sort of the weight of what we're dealing with here. So by offering a consent agreement, we're putting a lot of trust that these issues can be repaired.
Well said. And Dr. Bailey, would you jump back to the supervision and kind of the focus you'd like to see?
Sure. I think it would capture everything. So I think if I could list out everything, I think clinical, go ahead.
Well, I have them written down.
Awesome.
Arizona documentation, statutes, rules, boundaries, behavioral health, ethics, risk assessment, dual relationship.
Yeah. And then as well as good clinical cares, maybe we could just, would that be an umbrella of
clinical care?
Just so that we're also deeply and richly staffing the cases themselves. And are we delivering good care? Congruent maybe with her.
And based on what I hear, did you want to add a state suspension on there?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Okay. So I'll read back what we have. We'll be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. There'll be a state suspension. She'll be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics, 6 CEUs in risk assessment, 6 CEUs in Arizona documentation, 3 CEUs in continuity of care. She will also be required to come to 2 separate board meetings for 5 hours. In addition to that, she'll be required to get clinical supervision twice monthly for the first year. After the first year, at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, it could be reduced to monthly, but no early release. The focus is going to be on Arizona documentation, statutes and rules, boundaries, behavioral health ethics, risk assessment, dual relationship, and clinical care. And if not signed, remanded to a formal hearing.
Nicely done, and so moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey?
Aye.
Robert Charles?
Aye.
Mary Coonrod?
Aye.
Megan Kramer?
Aye.
Adelisa Meek?
Aye.
Diane Palacios?
Aye.
Mark Shin?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter?
Aye.
Thank you. So this concludes this matter, and if you have any further questions, you can reach out to your investigator next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we move now to 7G. Thomas Wood. Is the complainant present? No. Licensee and counsel? Mr. Wood and Mr. Carey. So if we could please hear the summary from board staff.
Yes. Chairperson and members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support ARS 3232516K as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics A6E non-professional interactions or relationships. This recommendation is based on the following. From 1021 to 1122, licensee provided therapy services to client at agency. In 11 of 22, client was discharged from agency and licensee resigned from his position. Client's father subsequently communicated to his therapist at agency that licensee was getting together with client once a month. Licensee represented the following in his written response. When licensee left agency, he was told to either facilitate a transfer in-house or close out the client. Client indicated he did not want to be transferred to another provider and opted to conclude treatment. Despite having a tool to communicate with clients through agency, licensee provided his number to clients. Due to a lack of support, licensee offered to stay in touch and occasionally check in with client. Licensee and client met twice after the conclusion of the treatment relationship. On 12/3/22, licensee met with the client to bring him some artificial turf for client's dog, and they went for a walk with the dog. On 1/22/23, licensee met client for brunch. Licensee recognizes he could have set clearer boundaries and could have either urged client to remain in counseling or ended any contact after ending treatment. Licensee phone records show 4 calls between 3:23 and 8:23, ranging in length from approximately 11 minutes to 39 minutes. Phone records also contained approximately 4 text messages, 4 text message records and 12 of 22. It is highly concerning that licensee not only continued to communicate with the client after the termination of services, but also met with him on multiple occasions. Additionally, licensee represented the following during his investigative interview. Licensee believes client did appear to still need services due to the way client kept shifting his focus on where he got his identity. Licensee does not think their continued communication could have prevented client from seeking out additional support. There have been a few clients licensee provided his phone number to and let them know they could reach out if they needed something, more so as a mentor and for encouragement rather than as a counselor. Licensee does not know how long he communicated with the former clients, but it would have been a couple of times, usually over a meal. One of the clients that reached out to him is a current client at his place of employment. Rather than encouraging client to seek out behavioral health services and ending the relationship, licensee continued to communicate and make himself available as a resource for client. A further concern, client is not only the former client licensee communicated with and had in-person interactions with after services had terminated, showing a pattern of behavior. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Avala. Any board members have questions for staff? Okay, so now you have licensee, Mr. Thomas, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I'm embarrassed that I ran into an ethical concern at the start of my career. I came from a number of professions in which I was actively encouraged to find as many ways to assist my clients or students as I could in their development, and I relied on that incorrectly when transitioning to counseling. The client was someone who I thought was really on the fence about continued counseling, and while I encouraged him not to quit, he was resistant and at times found excuses, including his busy schedule. I thought if I kept in touch, I could steer him in the right direction. In reviewing the board's report, I'm very happy to see he has, in fact, returned to counseling. The experience has shown me that there is a right way and a wrong way about engaging an individual and encouraging their continued growth. And I see that there are some necessary boundaries that we must set as a counselor, even if we want to do more for some clients or former clients. The training I have taken in boundaries, power dynamics, and working with teens and young adults has been really eye-opening and formative for me as a new professional. While I hope you believe I was coming from a place of wanting to help the client, I can see how there are many factors and dynamics that come into play and the importance of the somewhat more limited role of a counselor. Frankly, I'm glad that I've learned these lessons early in my career. I've taken everything that the board staff, has said in our interview and it is and its report seriously, and this has been a very significant learning experience for me.
And Chair Meek, members of the board, I'll be brief here. One thing that was I wanted to correct from the complainant was there wasn't monthly meetings or anything like that. There were two instances of contact after the relationship from a counseling perspective had terminated. As he mentioned, he's a new LAC, and although and he has a career, though, has extended back decades in helping people. He was the assistant director of refugee reestablishment, a professor at ASU, a lecturer to ESL students in Saudi Arabia, a crisis specialist, and a case manager. And he's gotten certificates in helping people. So he comes from a place of helping. And I think while counseling was a natural progression for him, counseling has its own, you're putting a little bit more of a box as a counselor than you may be if you're in other types of professions. And that's by design. In this case, he did have a few out of counseling contacts. Those occurred after the fact. As Board Member Bailey indicated, not a best practice, but ACA for reasons it decided back in, I think, 14 or 18, pulled back the idea that you can't have a relationship of any sort with a client after the relationship of counseling terminates. But again, not saying that this was necessary, the best approach in this case. But there was a situation here that gives some context in that the client had a busy schedule, had a busy sports schedule, licensee was departing the agency, and I think he was trying to meet the client or the former client where he was to get him back into services. And I think what's unique about this case or better about this case than some cases is there's not this significant course of text messages that goes page after page after page on the investigative report. I'm not trying to justify the fact that there was this contact, but it is much more discreet And that lends itself more to a belief that he was attempting to assist this young man as opposed to necessarily engaging in a long-term friendship or anything like that. I would note that he has taken 14 hours of CEU relevant to the areas. And I'm presuming the board here is going to want to see some additional education. He was extremely forthright with the board about the situation. Ms. Zavala did mention there were one or two other instances where he did engage with former clients in an attempt to be available to them. That's information the board would not have had without the licensee telling the board that information. So I think there's also the mitigator of him being full, fair, and cooperative with the board's investigation. This is one where I really do think that there is an opportunity for an NDCA. I think the motivations were good. I think the execution was not ideal. But I do think that if you look at the totality of the record, this is not a situation where he had a bad intent. I think this was bad execution, but I think his intent of trying to meet this young man where he was and get him into services, I think was important. I also think that the level of care that this young man needed was not, this wasn't a, someone who, if he did not receive counseling services, was going to need immediate, you know, inpatient or anything like that. This was someone who, I think if you go back to the investigative report, he needed, I think, some level of additional ability to talk to someone and bounce his feelings off of someone. And that's where this was motivated. So we would ask to consider an NDCA, just given the totality of this one and the limited scope of the potential issue.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for the licensee or his attorney?
Can I ask a question, Mr. Wynn? Can you tell me about the role of your supervisor? You're right now at the associate level licensure.
Yes.
And so can you tell me how you utilize supervision currently?
I see my supervisor. We do group supervision every other week. Okay. And then my supervisor works in the same place. I'm at Copper Springs at the moment. Mm-hmm. So she can do next week I'm supposed to have an individual where she comes in and watches. But I did – first thing I did when I got the grievance is I talked to my boss there and then talked to my supervisor, and they both have been supportive in saying, let's get you to the next training.
So they're aware of the process now.
Oh,
was your supervisor ever aware of the situation with this client? Or?
Oh, I told them everything, yeah.
Ahead of time, though?
Like, oh, no.
Like, how did we use supervision? Secondary, I didn't ask you that, so I'm sorry. Secondarily, how did you use supervision then in regards to these cases, giving out your cell phone number, how to decide which clients I'm going to give out my personal information, which clients am I just going to, you know, continue afterwards, even though I'm going to give them my information? Just how did we use your supervisor with these cases?
Because it was from a different context, I didn't put the two together.
Okay.
I had my license about 3 months when I moved to Copper Springs, and so I just kind of focused on supervision and what was going on there. When the situation arose, I talked to them, and so then we worked more on ethics and stuff.
Okay, so the ethical considerations on the boundaries or relationships you did not talk with your supervisor about?
Not until after the
report. Okay. And then just the second thing I just kind of needed to address because it just sat with me was when we say that we feel like we needed to go beyond the normal standard of client care. So I felt like I needed to give them extra support. They didn't have a lot of support. I don't think we can congruently then say this is not a vulnerable client, right? I think if we have a vulnerable client, I'm not saying it's right, but it would warrant more the idea of giving them the support. So if we're going to give them the support, I don't think we can say they're not a vulnerable client. So I just wanted to kind of go out there and say that just sat with me, just weird that if at all we feel like they needed something, that would automatically indicate some vulnerability. And so I would just encourage you to kind of just think about just that idea of vulnerable clients versus whatever else we might say.
Okay.
I do have a comment about a statement. I believe that it said to make it a good boundary crossing, it needs to be part of the treatment plan. Can you speak to that? What that means?
One of the CEUs I did was through the ZUR Institute, ZUR, and it talked about there are healthy boundary crossings, and it's just a point of putting it in a treatment plan and why you're doing it, what the purpose is, and then consents and all that sort of stuff. all the paperwork that's necessary for a client.
Okay.
And I believe that that's in relation to A6, where it talks about that change that was made in 18, where you that's where you can go to funerals and weddings and things. What they teach in that is, I believe, that's outside of the old ACA boundaries, but you can document if it is therapeutically probative or appropriate. So that's where that I think that's where that comes from. And
okay.
I don't agree with the terminology either, but that's what they use in that CE.
Okay. So kind of prepping, setting the stage, discussing, document. Okay. Thank you. Do you still give clients your phone number, your personal?
Okay. I was reminded during the investigation that we had this thing called Click at my previous place, and a lot of clients weren't getting the messages or they didn't get it. So if it was somebody I trusted, I gave them my number just work-wise. I always stressed I'm not crisis. This is not for that. It's just work-wise. So I don't have that problem in my new place. Okay. And if they need a number, I give them the work number.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm curious what your when you're faced with an ethical dilemma now or in the future, what would your process of determining what action to take would be? What would be your process?
Number one, go to my clinical supervisor, get her input on it, and talk when we have group supervision, get the input of everybody else, not hold it quiet.
Thank you.
So any other questions? No, so this is now the time for the board to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And Dr. Bailey, you're assigned to this.
Yeah. I think we have in just presentation today and the materials, I think it's clear that the violation happened.
Yeah.
I think we could do some good stuff with that, but I'll start if anybody's opposed to, does any of the material need to be clearer to warrant a firm decision on that? Okay. So I move that we do find for the violation. If anyone is considering a non-disciplinary consent agreement, I would like to see supervision that's not included in toward licensure. And I know that cannot be then a non-disciplinary consent agreement. And so I'm not prepared to offer an NDCA as just asked to consider, but I would also defer if anybody has other ideas about that. We could talk about that before I make the motion because for the violation.
I'm a little on the fence. I think we've seen this before with licensees who have been maybe in a ministry setting where the boundaries are a little bit not, you know, more fluid, mm-hmm. or, you know, working with refugees. It's you're taught like go above and beyond and kind of do whatever you need to do to get folks situated. And so I think it's kind of coming from that mentality is you do everything and everything in your power that you can to help folks. And so then shifting to a counseling or as a licensee, that can be a difficult shift. And that can be, if it's not, it's a harder shift because that hasn't been the career trajectory in the past. But having a license, there is that onus and that responsibility to work within the scope of the license, to work within the boundaries of the license. So I understand why that occurred and feel like, you know, there could be grace for that. But at the same time, there is also the statute, and we have to go by what the statute said.
If I may add, my kind of my thoughts are not finding for a violation, right, and doing a non-disciplinary based on, I think that the licensee understands the role that he has now versus the role of, you know, like a supportive mentor, like you mentioned before. And I was just kind of going to suggest that supervision, but I know that we can't add, but, you know, maybe recommend that supervision includes identifying red flags because, like, sometimes, right, is the identification of, right, there may be something here, mm-hmm. might be helpful to learn what might those red flags be, mm-hmm. instead of, oh, I have an ethical dilemma, right? There has to be awareness of the red flags. So, but I don't know how to do that with a non-disciplinary
consultation, maybe having a decision. I don't know if there's an actual CEU on decision tree making model.
Hmm. Oh, there is.
There is.
Mm-hmm. Because I think that could be helpful. I mean, anytime there's like, I have a question or what should I do? Or this isn't quite sitting right. Instead of just making a decision, going through that ethical decision tree making model, having consultation from multiple independently licensed folks is ideal. Mm-hmm. But I would say definitely a CEU on ethical decision making mm-hmm. model.
Is there anyone who's opposed to moving in that route of the NDCA?
No.
Isn't it rise to the levels is
considering what? Yeah.
Okay. Considering, yeah.
And I would add, considering the testimony today, I think the responsibility level taken today helps mm-hmm. me feel a little more comfortable in that way.
Yeah.
Because anytime that we're also, you know, extending our, you know, a non-professional relationship, that could be misinterpreted a lot of ways, right? We could be accused of our motives being a lot of different things. And so hopefully that's come to light now through this mm-hmm. process as well. Okay, so I'm not sure the language. Do I just say?
So we wouldn't be finding for the violation. You'd be offering a non-disciplinary consent agreement for 12 months. I heard.
And stipulate that.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I heard three CEUs in the decision-making model.
So since I'm kind of so passionate about the supervision piece, I have seen a few, and maybe we could have some grace on, you know, what the licensee finds. But I've seen some CEUs on how to effectively use supervision. At some point, I've seen that cross my desk. So that's why the only reason I'm coming up with that idea is I feel like I've seen it. So I would propose maybe that, and that would make me feel more comfortable about the idea of really how do we use our supervision? Mm-hmm. How do we be vulnerable? How do we recognize we're in a state where we have to really talk everything through, mm-hmm. you know, not only our good things, but our, you know, questionable things and questions.
I have a question for everybody, I guess. The supervision tutorial. I know that the licensee is not a supervisor, but I think there's a lot of valuable information there for a supervisee to know. Would that be a recommendation only? No? Only, I'm like, okay. Only if it was a disciplinary, we fine for the violation? Or anybody can take it?
I mean, anybody can take it, and you most definitely could add it to this non-disciplinary consent agreement. My opinion would be I'm not sure that it would be appropriate in this case. The clinical supervision tutorial really focuses on the rules and statutes of what meets in clinical supervision. There's not a lot of ethical pieces and or regards to relationships.
And it is a refresher type of thing, so it's also assuming you've taken the
12 hours.
Yeah. And he's a very new.
Yeah.
Agree.
Okay.
And all we can require is education, so we probably can't require attendance at a board meeting.
That would be education.
That's CEUs.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
So we would be offering a non-disciplinary consent agreement for 12 months. During that time, he would be required to take three CEUs in the decision-making model, three CEUs in effective use of clinical supervision and/or consultation, and five CEUs in attending a board meeting, if not signed, asked to participate in a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
Can I first ask? I did not write down where what he's taken so far. Is there? Does anybody know?
I'm not sure.
We
could just put a stipulation in there.
Okay.
If anything meets, it could be considered.
I can just give you the breakdown. I had just pulled it up. Board Member Bailey, it's 3 hours skills for working with adolescents, 2 for boundaries and psychotherapy and counseling for ethical and clinical, 5 in power dynamics, and 4 in ethical concerns when working with children and adolescents.
Okay. So I would like to add, how many did he take? 2?
On which ones?
Boundaries, sorry.
Boundaries. Oh, yeah. Boundaries is 2 CEU, and then there's a power dynamic, which is 5 CEU, which does cross over, but 2 directly on boundaries.
Okay, so I think just to memorialize it, Ms. Zavala, I think I'd like to say 2 on boundaries, and that way it's already been taken, but I'd like it memorialized in
and
there.
And that counts.
Uh-huh.
We're going to count the stuff, yeah.
That way it's in there that this is part of the problem. Let's the boundaries. So we'll add to that non-disciplinary consent agreement two CEUs and boundaries, and CEUs that have already been taken can be considered. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your motion? So moved. Yeah. Thank you.
Second?
Otter second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much. We go to 7C, Kavita Hayton. Do we have the complainant here? Is the licensee present? Thank you.
I was not just paying attention.
And Council David Klink?
Correct.
Okay. I'm sorry?
Is he co-overseeing?
Kavita?
Oh, okay.
Hayton?
No.
7C? Is that right?
Oh,
yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
So if we could listen to the summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support complainant's allegations. However, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record, and telepractice. This recommendation is based on the following. From 1193 to 7 of 2004, licensee was a certified professional counselor. Since 7 of 2004, licensee has been licensed as an LPC. Since 1999, licensee has been in private practice. From 2/28/23 to 5/5/23, licensee provided therapy services to client at her private practice. A review of client's consent forms showed the following required elements were missing. While it's noted that the client has the right to participate in treatment decisions and in the development of their treatment plan, it does not indicate that they have the right to participate in the review and revision of the treatment plan. The telehealth consent form is missing the manner of identifying the client when using electronic communication that does not involve video. Client's treatment plan was missing two required elements. Client's progress notes were missing two required elements. Due to licensee's consent forms and progress notes missing two required elements and the treatment plan's template missing one required element, all of licensee's client records thus far would be deficient. Since being credentialed with the board, licensee has renewed her certification approximately 5 times and renewed her license approximately 10 times. It is concerning that despite the renewal application's continuing education requirements, there was either a lack of focus in documentation requirements or ensuring documentation remained compliant with board rules. Additionally, since 10 of 19, licensee has been attesting in renewal applications that she's taken the Arizona Statutes Regulations tutorial, which covers documentation requirements. It's highly concerning that licensee has been certified and licensed with the board for approximately 30 years, but has client records that contain deficiencies. And that is all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for board staff? Okay, so licensee, you have, and your attorney, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. Attorney David Klink for licensee Kavita Hatton. I'll try to be brief. This is pretty much a standalone documentation case. My client was licensed, as Mr. Carver mentioned, since 1993. This is her first complaint. She's never had any other concerns that would have brought her under board scrutiny. The complaint in this case was filed by one of her patients' wives, and after a full investigation and full participation by my client, the allegations have not been substantiated. They were actually completely false. Your investigative report will note that the complainant in this case refused to respond to the investigator's inquiry and phone messages. So I'm pretty confident, and I think the board can be confident, and staff is confident, that there is no basis for the clinical concerns that were mentioned in the original complaint. Despite that, during the interview, we did the investigator did raise some technical concerns with the documentation that my client was using. we went back and forth with the investigator, regarding those concerns. And at this point, all of those concerns have been remedied, and her documentation at this point does comply with the administrative code requirements. My client, in addition to completing the revisions to the forms that were requested, has also completed 21 hours of continuing education, including 6.25 hours in documentation in response to this complaint. So in sum, this really is a standalone documentation complaint that has been completely remediated. We're asking you to view this and recognize that my client has viewed this as a learning opportunity, but there really aren't any clinical patient care concerns here. So at the end of the day, we're asking the board to recognize that the complaint was false and unsubstantiated, that my client has professionally responded and participated in this investigation as the board has requested of her, and that there's nothing more for the board to do at this point in time to remediate the concerns that were identified in this investigation. When you look at academics that view the purpose of healthcare licensing boards in American society, the academic articles always reflect and highlight the fact that the function of licensing boards is not to be punitive, but it is to be remedial. And in this case, there's no more remediation that needs to occur. When you look at page 12 of your investigative reports and the Arizona Administrative Code provisions that guide your disciplinary decisions in cases like this, you'll note there are seven factors that the board is to consider. And all seven of those factors, I would submit to you, weigh in favor of my client. She has no prior disciplinary offenses. There's no dishonest or self-serving motive here. There's no pattern of misconduct, no bad faith, no submission of false evidence, no refusal to acknowledge, and there was no vulnerability of the victim. In this case, given what we've just demonstrated and our written response to the board taken as a whole, we'd ask the board seriously consider dismissing this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any board members have, do you have any statement? Okay. Any board members have a question for licensee or attorney? No questions? Okay, so now it's time for the board to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And Mr. Shin, you're leading the discussion.
It was. So I reviewed the entire record. I'm prepared to make a motion, but just want to see if anyone else, any of my peers, have anything to add before I do that. So I guess where I'm stuck is I was going to recommend NDCA, but I'm not sure what education I would ask for because she did 27 and a half hours of education already. So
can I ask a question first? Just to make sure we're on the same page.
Please.
Are we not going to fine for the violations? I just want to sort of talk that out because.
Okay. Do you have a, you want to discuss?
Yeah.
Okay.
If that's okay before a motion is made, you know, I think we have consistently, when violations occur, found for the violations, regardless of whether, you know, something has been since remediated. And I think anytime there's a documentation case, if we decided not to find for the violations, you know, we wouldn't, it wouldn't serve as a deterrent at all for people to, you know, not have huge documentation issues. And I think we have consistently, you know, said that documentation issues are clinical. I think we've said that a couple of times today. And so for that reason, I am inclined to fine for the violations. I think we know that they occurred and we've had an admission today and we can still only order, you know, still only order education. But that was just my thought. I just want to try to be consistent because I think that's what we've done in the past.
Chairperson, can I respond to that and speak
yes,
to
ma'am.
That? So I think that Ms. Kramer is and I appreciate it as an administrator making sure that we stay consistent. You know, oftentimes we have a clinical case that comes before us where there's documentation issues and then there's no question. On occasions, we have cases that come before us where the allegations aren't proven, but yet we have clinical documentation issues. And sometimes, on occasion, if they're minimal and or they work possibly for an agency, we have been known to consider an NDCA. But I think we need to recognize that this individual's been licensed since 1993. And I think that that's something that's important, that our members have consistently considered that they're in private practice. And if you're going to have that responsibility of taking your own private practice, I mean, that's a long time to be practicing and not meet the board's rules. But you obviously can offer an NDCA. The other option is if you chose to find the violation and felt that she had enough education or this was enough a learning tool to go through this process, you could do the lowest level of discipline, and that's do an issue a decree of censure.
which would require her not to have to do anything. And then another note, just to a point of reference, I believe that Mr. Klink mentioned she had taken a number of hours. All of those hours were used towards her renewal, which obviously if we were to ask for education to be done, it can't be used towards a renewal. So just things to consider.
Yeah, and I guess I hadn't remembered. So sometimes what we have done is if the documentation issue we learn about, that, and there's another violation that we don't substantiate, then we do offer NDCAs, I guess, is what you're saying, Ms. Zavala.
Yes. I mean, we see, you know, the way board staff looks at it when we make our recommendations, and I hope that the board members see it the same way, like there's this pendulum where things land. And we see them often with different types of allegations. Where does it lie? You know, if you're working for an agency and there's one or two elements, you know, missing, yes, you as a licensee are responsible, but does that rise to a level of discipline? You know, again, I think that a board has seen it very differently when somebody's been in private practice than somebody that works for an agency. And it's somewhat egregious when there's a number of them. But again, you can do an NDCA, which is not finding the violation, require that she take additional education. You can fine for the violation and stipulate more education or anything else. You can also fine for the violation and do the lowest level of discipline, which is the issue, the decree of censure, which is no stipulations.
I guess since I sort of got us off on this tangent, I'll just say after having the discussion, I would be okay offering a non-disciplinary consent agreement and probably not. We don't do censures very often. Ms. Zavala's laughing at me. I guess I just
want to make sure. I think, and again, the members get to make the decision, but we need to be consistent in what we've been doing. And forever, if they're in private practice and there's significant documentation issues, we fine for the violation. So yeah. If you are going to go down a different path today, then I'm asking that you memorialize why somebody that's been licensed since 1993 is not going to be disciplined. Because that's going to be important for all those that have come before us in the past.
Let me put it this way. I want to hear from my clinician colleagues.
Well, and the biggest issue I have with it is the length of time she's been licensed. And if she's been doing it this way all along, I think it's got to be a disciplinary.
So I'm comfortable with the degree of censure. That's what I was thinking, Mr. Chen, when you were talking, is I didn't know where that fell necessarily, but I was comfortable with that. But I am good with memorial, or I am good with finding for the violations. We've had a lot of tutorials on documentation in that many years to at least be making changes along the way. And I don't hear that, you know, with every board, with every renewal, some changes and updates were made. If we had maybe some testimony to that, and some things just still, you know, gosh, I made all these changes. How did I miss that one? You know, I would feel differently, but I don't know that things were looked at until this came up to light. I mean, we've got every 3 years for the last 15 plus years, at least 5 renewals. My math's bad, but right.
And 4 forms that have issues. So,
mm-hmm. What would a decree of censure? We don't do that often. What does that mean?
It's the lowest level of discipline. So you would fine for the violation and the board would offer a decree of censure. Basically, it would go on their record, but they would not be required to take any education or do any other stipulations.
But it is a disciplinary.
It is disciplinary.
You fine for the violation.
That is correct.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate what Ms. Kramer has mentioned. You know, I guess I was looking at it from a sense of like the egregiousness of the deficiency. Like I was just thinking 30 years is a long time. I agree. And a lot of tutorials have occurred to where you would think you would go and make these changes. And then I was looking at it and thinking, well, maybe if there are more problems in those files we reviewed, we would have found more. With that being said though, I hear that the precedence is, you know, 30 years and in private practice that, you know, you'd hope that the documentation would be in tip top shape after many, many tutorial. So I'm going to change my motion. And I am going to fine for the violation of documentation deficiencies 32, 32, 51, 16P.
Second, Kramer.
As it relates to 1101, 1102, 1103, and 1106.
Yes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 And now we, the recommendation?
I would recommend a decree of censure.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We need a roll call.
Oh, roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Good. Thank you very much for attending. If you have any further questions, you can contact your investigator. Okay. Ms. Coonrod has to leave at 11:57. Now we move to item 7D. Sarah Kirster is a license. Is the complainant here? You're the licensee?
License.
Okay. The complainant's not here? Okay. Thank you. Are we ready for to hear the summary?
And just for the record, Madam Chair, as this is a release from the ICA, the complainant was not invited to attend today's meeting.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
So just a brief overview.
And should we say on the record?
I believe.
Oh, okay. I'll listen better.
So just as a reminder, licensee Kircher is currently on an ICA, which means her license is currently suspended. The matter is before the board members today to consider whether or not they feel that the licensee is in a position to be released from that ICA. And that's the first decision. Instead of going down the rest of the information, I think we probably should start there. I also want to make it very clear that the reason she was on the ICA was for substance use issues as well as behavioral health issues. Therefore, I'm not going to read anything in the analysis as it relates to that. I think that the information in there is rather thorough. With that being said, if any member has questions for Ms. Kircher, I would ask that you ask if she wants to go into executive session. Again, the first step that the board members need to make is whether or not you feel that she's in a position to be released from the consent agreement. If the answer is yes, we'll move forward with considering finding the violations and offering a consent agreement, which will keep her in a rehabilitation process if we feel necessary. If you don't feel that she's in a position to be released, then we are going to memorialize that and end the conversation for today and offer her more time before being released. Is that?
Yeah.
Ms. Saval, I have a question.
Yes.
So the discussion related to whether the board believes that she's ready to go back, is that confidential as well?
Well, I mean, I think that the board members are in a position, if they feel like the analysis is thorough enough, which I believe that maybe mm-hmm. you may be able to have that discussion without referring to any issues that are within there. It may be a simple discussion as yes or a simple discussion as no, or it may be that you want to have a further conversation and go in executive session where Ms. Kircher can be with us to ask further questions. I just want to be careful that we're not mentioning any diagnoses or any issues with her behavioral health issues in an open setting.
I would like to propose that if anyone thinks the answer is no, that we go to executive session, because I think it would be helpful to receive feedback of why the answer is no.
I think I would like to do that. So going to executive session, do we?
Yeah, we'll go into executive session to review confidential information.
At 12.
Again.
So I propose that we move into executive session.
Second, Kramer.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The board is back in session at 12:16, and we are with case 7D, Tara Kircher. The board members need to decide if we believe that the licensee is safely to practice. Do we make a motion, or Ms. Zavala, we're just, okay. Okay. I agree that she's safe. Is there anybody?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Thank you. So now we move to listen to the case, the summary of the case, is that right, Ms. Zavala?
No, Madam Chair, because everything that's in the analysis would be confidential.
Okay.
Based on our discussion today. So what the members need to consider are the two violations. One is the L violation, for the behavioral health and substance use issues, and the other is in regards to the misrepresentation portion.
Okay. Mr. Shen, you're leading the discussion.
Yeah, so I move that we fine for the violations. Substance use, behavioral health concerns, 32, 3251, 16L, and sorry, I'm scrolling here. Misrepresentation 32, 3251, 16C, double I.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And can we have recommendations?
Yes. So I first just want to go on record and say I commend the licensee for being so vulnerable, but also the work that she's put into her own healing and recovery. I would like to offer a consent agreement for 2 years with several different stipulations. I'd like to see clinical supervision at least twice a month for the first 12 months, and then less, but at least monthly in the second year. I'd like to see an individual counseling, but I'd like to see that twice a month. I think it's just going to be good for the healing process. And I'd be okay with twice a month the first year and then at least once a month minimal in the second year based off of counsel recommendation. What else do I have here? Those are my main ones. Other recommendations for that? Yeah. One, and continue to see the psychiatric care. I'd like to see that for the.
And then no early release, right? Or are you doing early release?
Continue the psychiatric.
Yeah.
Would we want to consider maybe a stayed suspension just in case of relapse?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
We always do that in these types of cases when they're mm-hmm. released. So the psychiatric care, is there a continuation? Are you going to put a requirement on that?
Well, I was just going to say, based off of the provider's recommendation, mm-hmm. it's hard for me to say see you monthly when that's out of my scope.
Consistency and follow provider recommendations.
Yeah.
Okay.
May I ask a question?
Give me 1 second. Ms. Zavala, do you need anything else from us?
I would like to repeat that, but just for clarity for the members, based on what was discussed in executive session, if you want to take a look at the misrepresentation portion, I respect the fact where the licensee is coming from and things that may possibly look different in the report, but when you actually look at the analysis, we're not mentioning the behavior that was mentioned there. Mm-hmm. We mentioned another behavior.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So I just want to be clear that we're not putting anything in there that's not accurate.
Okay.
And then did you want to let her ask a question first, or do you want me to repeat it?
Yeah, if you can ask your question first.
No, sir, you were saying per recommendation. Is that for psychiatric or therapy or both?
Yes, for both.
Both.
And all...
Twice a month for a full year.
Correct. So it's twice. And if you want to read back,
what if we I have, could ask, so. If I could ask a question of Ms. Kircher.
Sure. Yes.
We know that you're receiving the therapy. Are you also seeing the psychiatric provider as well? Still.
Yes, I have been with her for 2 years.
And how often do you do that?
Roughly once a month.
Okay.
What has been?
I think I can.
Okay. So Ms. Zavala is going to read what we just discussed.
So we would be offering a consent agreement for 24 months. We would be adding a stayed suspension to that. She would be required to continue the therapy that she is receiving based on the concerns that we have in the report, meaning that the therapist will receive a copy of the report. She will see that therapist twice monthly after the first year at the recommendation of the therapist, but no less than once monthly. In addition to that, she will continue to see the psychiatrist that she's been seeing at the recommendation of that psychiatrist. If not signed, she will stay on the interim consent agreement. Is that your motion?
So moved.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Roll call, please.
Aye. Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. So that
just for clarity, my staff is saying that somebody mentioned clinical supervision.
Oh yeah, that was actually part of it.
And just to be clear, I would ask the members to discuss that if that's something you want to put on here, being that this is in regards to her rehabilitation and not so much clinical care.
Hmm. Good point. I don't think that would be appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed.
Intentionally omitted.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Agreed. So does that go towards my clinical?
No, they weren't requiring clinical supervision. They're just requiring the therapy part.
Yeah.
Okay. So am I free then to, obviously I'm doing clinical supervisions.
Clinical supervision is going to be very different. What I would ask that you do is your investigator can answer a lot of these questions for you. We'll provide you with a consent agreement that's going to have the therapy portion and the psychiatric portion in there. If you sign it, then you'll be released from your ICA and you'll be able to practice. You'll be able to get clinical supervision, you know, towards your hours, et cetera.
Towards my hours, okay. Yeah, that's what I want.
And if you have additional questions, you can reach out to your investigator. Thank you very much for being here. And
Is there an early release to this?
No.
No, it's 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Take care. All right. We move to 7F. Sandra Ritter. Is the licensee here?
The licensee has notified us that she was having issues with her GPS, so she's going to be on the phone.
Huh?
And did you ask if the complainant was here?
Yes.
Okay.
Is there a complainant here? No complaint.
Sandy Ritter.
Hi, Ms. Ritter. This is Adalisa Meek. I'm the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's chairperson, and we're ready to address your case.
Okay.
So just to remind you that this is a public meeting, it will be recorded, and I'm here sitting with members of the board, members of the staff, and also public members. So first we're going to listen to the summary of your case that is going to be read by a board staff, and then you will be able to address the board. So as we listen to the report, if you can please put your phone on silence, please.
Okay, now, I am hearing a lot of echoing, and it's very difficult for me to understand what you're saying. Is there a way of getting closer to a microphone, whoever's speaking?
Okay, can you hear me better?
Yes, that's better.
Okay, so we are going to listen to a summary of your case first, and then you will have an opportunity to address the board. I also said that this is a public meeting and it will be recorded. We have members of the public sitting here in the audience and also members of the staff and board members. So we're going to be listening to that summary first.
Okay.
And you can put your phone on silence, please. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support complainant's allegations. However, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16M, engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience. This recommendation is based on the following. During the course of board staff's investigation into complainant's complaint, it was found that licensee has completed various paperwork and forms for clients such as FMLA and disability paperwork and ESA letters. A 421-23 ESA letter completed for a client included the following. Licensee recommended the client have a dog or cat to help with stress reduction and that emotional support animals significantly reduce anxiety for owners. A 4-4-23 request for extension of FMLA included the following. The client has been seen by licensee twice in the past 2 weeks for anxiety
and requested licensee complete the letter in support of extending their FMLA. Licensee recommended the client have full absence from work for 4 weeks beyond the current date. Once the full absence time expires, the client can begin reentry into work with decreasing amounts of FMLA. A 5/20/21 healthcare provider document completed by licensee included the following. The duration of the health condition will last 1 year. Licensee diagnosed the client with acute stress and grief. The client requires a continuous period of leave due to the medical condition. The client will require a reduced schedule and can work 4 days a week for 32 hours per week. The client's stress would be greatly reduced if they could work from home a few days a week instead of requiring that they're exposed to COVID in a medical setting. The client would be able to work full duty starting 1/1/22. Licensee inappropriately inserted her opinion regarding a client's need for an emotional support animal when she was contracted to be the client's therapist to treat them for behavioral health issues. As a licensed therapist, licensee's scope is to provide psychotherapy services to clients, which includes treating, diagnosing, assessing, and evaluating. Licensee represented the following regarding completing these types of forms. Since 2018, she's completed more than a dozen FMLA or disability documents and approximately four ESA letters. Licensee does not have any formal training regarding ESA letters or completing FMLA and disability paperwork. Licensee believed this was within her scope because she only completed them if she believed her client had a disability for a mental health reason. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to treatment plan, client record, and telepractice. This recommendation is based on the following. From 3/23 to 4/23, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant. At the onset of services, licensee had complainant complete informed consents, which failed to include all of the required elements. Licensee failed to devise any sort of treatment plan for complainant during the course of treatment. Licensee's progress notes also failed to include two elements. During board staff's investigative interview, licensee represented the following regarding treatment plans and documentation. She had gotten away from doing treatment plans when she began private practice in 2018. Licensee moved away from formal treatment plans for ease of documentation and efficiency of sessions. Licensee used the care plan section at the bottom of the progress notes as the goals for therapy. Licensee believes she reviewed board rules on documentation standards in 2018. It is highly concerning that licensee failed to develop any treatment plans for any of her clients due to ease of documentation when treatment plans are required by board rules. Furthermore, in 2020 and 2022, licensee completed her renewal applications, which required her to complete the board's tutorial regarding statutes and regulations, which specifically provides education on training on clinical documentation. Despite completing the tutorial on documentation standards twice, licensee has been in private practice for roughly 5 years without implementing minimum board requirements. Since being notified of the deficiencies, licensee provided updated forms that meet requirements. Additionally, following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16S, terminating behavioral health services to a client without making an appropriate referral for continuation of care for the client if continued behavioral health services are indicated. This recommendation is based on the following. From 3/23 to 4/23, licensee provided services to complainant. In complainant's final session with licensee on 4/6/23, there was no indication that licensee planned to refer complainant elsewhere or that complainant no longer needed services. On 4/19/23, complainant texted licensee the following. She thought about their previous session and decided she would not be rescheduling. Complainant was specific about what she wanted, and licensee is not willing to provide that. Complainant should not have to explain and defend her situation every week. In 4/19/23, licensee responded to complainant stating she had similar feelings and thinks it was best if they did not schedule any additional sessions. Despite complainant initiating the termination of services, licensee failed to ensure any sort of continuity of care was in place. Licensee acknowledged that she believed complainant needed continued therapy services at the time of the termination of services. Additionally, licensee represented that at the next therapy session with complainant, she anticipated discussing referring complainant to another provider. It is concerning that licensee took zero steps to ensure any sort of continuity of care for complainant and even acknowledged that she had planned to refer complainant elsewhere at the next session. That is all I have unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for staff? No questions? Ms. Ritter, are you still there?
Well, it was well read. There was only one point where I heard it differently than the paperwork indicates, and that is, let me see, second page of the analysis, point 8. I thought I heard in A, since 2018, licensee has completed more than a dozen, and my paperwork says less than a dozen FMLA or disability documents. So I'd like to just clarify that.
This is Toby Zavala, the executive director. It may have been read more, but to be clear, it does state less in the documents that the board members have.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the clarification. So, Ms. Ritter, you have up to six minutes to address the board.
I do have some comments about this. Most of them are, well, positive to the analysis, but negative to me. All right. With regard to existing boundaries of competence, this indicates I've been practicing in Arizona for 5 years, but I've been a licensed counselor for more than 30 years. And I personally believe that doing FMLA and ESA letters are within our scope of competence, and I understand the board has recently made the decision otherwise on that. I will follow the recommendations of the board and not do those letters anymore, but I do believe that most counselors, when they have established clients, can apply, it is appropriate and ethical for them to apply their own judgment in doing such things. I have nothing further to say on that one. On the next, yes, I do have documentation deficiencies that have now been corrected. Let me see. One area under documentation deficiencies, Item 3, it says licensee failed to deliver any sort of treatment for complainant during the course of treatment. I think my progress notes indicate that we did an assessment of major issues that she considered her trauma and also worked a lot on resource installation, helping her find ways to de-escalate, to relax, to release some of the trauma when it has been triggered, which are essential criteria to have in place prior to doing any EMDR. And this is where I believe we got bogged down because I wasn't jumping right into the EMDR. Don't know that for sure. I acknowledge most of the rest of these statements. I would like to state that, yes, I was not doing formal treatment plans, but if you look at, again, the progress notes that I submitted in the planning stage at the end of the note, there is the course of treatment that I had outlined in the notes indicated I had reviewed these with the client and that she understood this course of treatment. So I had a plan and it was not documented appropriately is what I'm comfortable saying. Let's see. And then the last comment that I have is I have no defense, and I agree that there was inappropriate termination of services. When she communicated this with me, I should have recommended she contact her insurance company to see if there was someone else, because that is the way that, if I recall correctly, she had contacted me originally, was a recommendation from her insurance. Otherwise, I would like to say that this was a very comprehensive report, and I think the analysis is, for the most part, very appropriate, and I agree with it.
Thank you very much. Any board members have any questions for the licensee?
I just had a quick question. Ms. Schroeder, this is Mark Shen. Just to clarify, you do have a separate treatment plan document that you do now with clients. Is that correct?
I do have a what? I didn't understand the rest of that.
But I just want to clarify, you do currently have a separate treatment plan that you complete with clients outside of documenting in a progress note, right?
I have, yes. As I have now developed and my EHR has, my new EHR system has in it, a treatment plan that I am using with my clients.
Okay, thank you.
Chairperson Meek, for Ms. Ritter as well as for the public, can I just make a statement in regards to disability letters?
Okay, yes,
please. I just want to be clear because this is something that's come up consistently over the last 2 months is I keep hearing people are saying the board has made the decision that you can't do disability letters. I just want to be clear, the board has never found it within, well, rarely has found it within the scope of a licensee to write letters. The purpose of memorializing it in the minutes was that we were able to just to clarify and provide more information. So I just want to be clear, like this wasn't a recent decision that the board members made, that the members never have felt that it's within the scope to go outside your therapeutic relationship and write letters.
You're correct, Ms. Zavala. Thank you. So Ms. Ritter, right now is going to be time for the board to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. So if you can put your phone on silence again. And we have Ms. Palacios, you're leading.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala, for stating that I was going to bring that up in our discussion. So you beat me to it. So I think it's, I don't know if you have anything that board members you would want to discuss. I think, like board staff had stated, there doesn't appear to be clear and convincing for the complaint allegations, however, that there is for documentation, extending matter of competence. So I'm prepared to make a motion, but would like to hear from everybody else prior to making a motion.
And just in case someone is listening to this and had not previously heard our discussion, I just wanted to say not only is it outside the scope of practice, and I am a convert on this issue, but it's also gives potential for a conflict of interest, exploitation, and a dual relationship. Mm-hmm. To write these letters because you're providing psychotherapy and then you're also making statements to a third party about your client. And so we just sort of memorialized that, like Ms. Zavala said, but it has always been so.
Correct. Any other comments?
We're ready for a motion.
We're ready for a motion. Okay. So I am proposing that we fine for violation of extending matters of competence, ARS 32-3251-16M, engaging or offering to engage as a licensee activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience, as well as documentation deficiencies, ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board, as it relates to AAC R461102 treatment plan, AAC R461103 client record, AAC R461106 telepractice, as well as inappropriate termination of services, ARS 32-3251-16S, terminating behavioral health services to a client without making appropriate referral for continuation of care for the client. Continuing behavioral health services are indicated. That's my motion.
Thank you.
Second, Kramer.
Okay, and you're ready to provide some documentation, some recommendation?
Do we need a vote?
Yeah, no.
All in favor?
It's a violation.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I'm good. All right.
So,
I said, motion.
We didn't vote.
Didn't she say all in favor?
No.
No.
Oh, we just second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Some recommendations would be CEUs on continuity of care, including termination of clients, some documentation. So I think three CEUs on
on continuity of care or something of that nature. Documentation, 3 CEUs. And practicing within scope. And board staff, do we know, has the documentation been verified that it meets board standards at this point?
We have.
We have. So it does currently meet. Yes. Okay. So that would be, those are the things right now I'm thinking of. Other suggestions? No, does that feel like it captures what we would like to capture? Okay, well, that would be my motion then. Ms. Savala?
We'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months, 3 CEUs in continuity of care and 3 CEUs in Arizona documentation. If not signed, invite to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
And also practicing within scope of practice.
So 3 CEUs in scope?
Scope of practice.
Do we have a second?
10 second.
All in favor? Roll call.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. This concludes this matter. Ms. Ritter, you're free to go. And if you have any additional questions, you can contact your investigator next week.
Thank you. The one question I have, because of the communication issue with hearing you, I heard something about a reference to a consent decree for 12 months. Could someone explain that to me, or is that going to be explained in the paperwork I received?
Your investigator will be reaching out to you with, they'll give you a clear explanation, and if you have any questions, they will answer at that time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, moving right along. Item 9, denials.
The Counseling Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 2 applications based on a failure to pass the required examination, 9 applications based on a failure to take the required examination, 9 applications based on a failure to meet minimum requirements. Total denials, 20.
Palacios, second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. We have 1 application based on a failure to pass the required examination and 1 application based on a failure to take the required exam, for a total of 2 denials.
Do I have a second?
Palacios, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications for the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 13 applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, 4 applications based on a failure to take the required examination, and 2 applications based on a failure to meet minimum requirements. Total denials equaling 19.
Bailey, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Substance Abuse Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 1, application based on the failure to pass the required examination, and 6 applications based upon the failure to take the required examination. Total denials equaling 7.
I have a second.
Bailey, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Pressure report. So we table number 11B, the December financials, and do we have a motion to approve November financials?
Bailey, so moved.
Do we have a second?
Kramer, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Approved. Report from Executive Director, Ms. Zavala.
Let me go up to licenses issued. What? Would you just state how many licenses are issued for the month?
Oh, please.
And we should be really proud of this number because I'm not sure I've seen it this high. 311.
Wow. Wow. Thank you. Thank you, staff.
All right, Madam Chair, members of the board. So I wanted to have just a brief discussion in regards to 2024 pending legislation. And first and foremost, I have the pleasure in stating that this year has looked a little bit different, meaning that I'm in constant communication with legislators, representatives, and senators in the governor's office in regards to legislation that's coming down the pike. There's going to be a number of legislation that hits our board that, in my opinion, is going to be very positive. Some of these have been uploaded for review. To just briefly state, one is the social work compact. The other one is the counseling compact. These are both the counseling compact. We should have been on board about 3 years ago. Social work compact. This is really the first year we've had an opportunity. So excited about both of those. A couple of others that are coming that have been introduced. One is Senate Bill 1062. That's also been uploaded for review, and this is all public information, so you can research it online as well. But this has been something that's been talked about for 13 and a half years, that, again, I think is a really positive change, and that is changing the title to substance abuse counselors to addiction counselors. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, it would expand their scope, and when I say expand their scope, in my opinion, it basically would put it in line with their scope that they were being educated in. But our state, for whatever reason, back in 2004, limited their scope to substance abuse only. So this particular bill, if passes, will open up the scope for any addiction behavior, which is a process theory, whether it's sexual addiction, media addiction, eating disorders, any type of gambling, which, I think is in line with the education that they receive in this process. So, I think it's a positive. The other one is HB 2473, and this one's kind of an interesting one. Years ago, they put something on our board that basically says, so we have the associate level and then we have the independent level, and sometimes it seemed like you were paying double because your renewal came up at the same time you were getting licensed. And this was one of those bills that they didn't communicate, and they just introduce it, and then they accept it, and they kind of miss the other piece. This is adding an additional piece, which, again, I think is significant for our licensees and our applicants. It says that the board shall waive the renewal fee for an associate-level license if the licensee has submitted the renewal application and the licensee's application for independent licensure and pending at the time of renewal. This is basically so people don't have to pay for something twice. Obviously, it's going to be, a little bit less revenue for the board, but that was never our intent. Our intent is to, ethically, treat our licensees and applicants. But this now allows for us to basically, if they're applying for independent at the same time they have to renew, they only have to pay for one, which is, I think, super significant.
The friend to ask, like, what would happen if they don't get the independent license for some reason?
That'll have to come in rules.
Okay.
It won't thank state you that in law, but that'll definitely be something in rules.
Okay.
And it may be that they still don't have to pay. Most people that apply for independent license, they eventually get there. It just may take them a little bit longer, and then we keep their application open.
Okay, thanks.
The other bill that's going to be coming down the pike that hasn't been introduced yet, Dr. Bailey's going to really like this one. This is in regards to somebody that has a temporary license. So right now, the way it looks is when you get a temporary license, it's only good for 12 months. In addition to that, though, let me back up a little bit. So if somebody graduates from their graduate level program, there's always a transition where they have anywhere from a week to 2 months where they can't practice. So if that individual is working for a practice that's not licensed by DHS and they want to continue seeing clients, they can't. So there's a lack of continuity of care for those clients because they have to wait until they get that temporary license. If this bill gets introduced and passed, it will allow them to stay
As long as they're in their internship with supervision, they'll be able to stay there and continue to practice until they get their temporary license. So there is another bill that's out there that hasn't been introduced yet, and it's one that's a little bit more of a concern that I've been speaking with the governor's office about, as well as every other health board that's in the state of Arizona, and it's what they call, I think it's called the Health Reform Bill. It has not been introduced yet. If it is introduced, it's going to be very, very concerning for, in my opinion, for all health boards. But I'm consistently working with the lobbyists for that, as well as the representative that wants to introduce that, as well as making sure the governor's office is aware of all the concerns and issues that this could create, specifically for our board, if that bill were to be introduced and or passed. I'll probably do this probably every month, just briefly kind of let you know where things are going. I'm sure that Mr. Charles knows they either get traction or they don't, but you have a pretty good idea at the beginning what it's going to look like. I think all the bills I mentioned today, other than the reform bill, are probably going to get some decent traction, which I think are really going to be beneficial, particularly to our licensees and applicants, which I think is great.
Yeah, thanks for your work.
Are we carrying 1062, or is that
in say that one more time?
1062, are you carrying that, or is that an association?
That's an association, yeah. So, but again, what's been different this year is they're actually, you know, reaching out, and there's this effort that we're all included, and that's the way it used to be. And then we got like cut out of that for like six years. So you just waited for it to be introduced and then tried to fix it. So I think it's a good thing. So technically the board is not in a position to carry or run for anything. I'm a registered lobbyist, but we're not allowed to lobby. So I use it as an educational experience. So that's how I communicate. In fact, last week, Thursday, I actually went to a fundraiser event with Senator Gowin and Representative
Montenegro.
Yes. And so that's, you know, when we just get out there and educate as much as we can. So it's a nice position to be in for our board.
Can I ask another quick question before you move on? Mm-hmm. Very quick. In the addiction, it's looking like we've changed the scope, like the language around scope. So is that also changing the license title?
Yeah, so the license title will be addiction counselor.
Okay. And so you guys have to make, we have to make all those changes. Okay. I just wanted to recognize, I mean, it's a lot of work.
There's a bill, you know, then you have to do rules, and it's a lot of work. I'm not, okay. I mean, it is what it is. But once it's in statute, those rules are automatic in a sense. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it is going to be some work, but we should have been calling them addiction counselors years ago. Mm-hmm. It's the right title. In most states, that's what they do. In most states, their scopes are open too. I don't know how we got to where we were at.
Can I ask how it will be designated from an LAC? Like, what's that going to look like? Do you know yet? Because right, if you just went
like,
by,
like
what's AC? The
Yeah,
so just addiction. We'll drop the licensed. Otherwise, it's an LAC.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's not something that we've come up with yet, and it may be something that the board's able to come up with, because mm-hmm. we don't use LPCs or LACs in our statutes or rules. It's spelt out.
Right.
So that might be a discussion y'all should be thinking, what is that going to look like? And maybe we just call them addiction counselors. Mm-hmm. But that's a great question.
Okay. Thank you.
Anytime we can eliminate an acronym, I'm in favor of that.
Me too.
We're going to table the telephone platforms because that's something that Ms. Knapp had wanted to be on, and she's not here today. So the next topic, the update on the portal implementation. So I'm going to try to make this super, super short. But at the end of the day, we as a board, we're in a position where, you know, for lack of better words, we were forced to go to e-licensing. There was no choice. We actually jumped ship and went for it faster than the state told us we had to. Aaron has put in countless hours with the chosen Ventia, who's the e-licensing platform, and it's been rough. And we introduced it, and I'm choosing my words here. We introduced this in August, and board staff, lack of better words, Aaron Yabu, had everything under control, everything in place where it needed to be, and they didn't carry through. And so we have been fighting since August on a regular basis
The front end looks pretty good for our licensees and for our applicants. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback. The back end for our staff has been horrendous. We've had to pay overtime. We've had to hire two temporaries because we can't hire any more staff. And it's just been rough. And I'm telling you all that today because every month when we think it's going to be a little bit better, it's not. My last conversation, I think, was on December 23rd, and it was made very clear that if we didn't figure this out by the end of January, we're going back to where we used to be, and then that's going to be another fight with everyone in the state. But we can't operate on this, on the caliber that we're operating. We're getting further and further behind on all of our applications. Staff is getting burned out. It's very frustrating. But I want to be very clear that this is not a staff issue. This is a product issue. And as the administrator, I take full responsibility. And they're coming in next week as kind of a mandate. They wanted to come in this week. We said no. So they're coming in next week, a team of, I think, five from Canada to get us to where we're supposed to be. These are the same issues we've been discussing since August, and we're still not there. So I have really nothing positive to say about it other than we will be making a decision by the end of the month if we can't get there, and we're going to have to go backwards, which is going to be really tough, but it's going to be better for the board moving forward. And this is really hard for me to share because this has been a lot of staff time and work, but we can't keep operating the way we're operating. So there's that. let's talk about some exciting things. Okay. F, the 2024 sunset audit, as promised, is going to be on the agenda every month. It is definitely in place. It's definitely moving. I don't have a whole lot to say about it other than so far it's been very positive for our board. I think it's going to get rougher as time goes on. But I think between Ms. Yabula, myself, and some of our other managers, we're going to be able to get through it. We have to remember auditors want to find things wrong. So there will be things wrong when we're done, but that's okay because we're not doing anything illegal or unethical. So we just need to keep responding back to their requests, getting them the information that they have. We did have, I'm not sure what they called it, like a test run, I think they called it. They came to our board's office and very uncomfortable. We sat there for like an hour and we all got all the way done. We got 100% and we got an email back stating that. So, that was just the beginning of the icing, though. But anyway.
It's a start with 100%.
It is. The next thing is review consideration of possible action regarding board member attendance at the Counseling Regulatory Board's annual summit for National Board for Certified Counselors. I brought this up last month just to put it out there. This month it is on for an action vote. Yesterday they sent out the registration for it. So let me just repeat what this looks like. This is an annual summit that is put on from CCE and NBCC, and this is where three individuals are fully funded to attend this conference each year. This is something our board has consistently done since I can remember. With that being said, this year it is a kind of an exciting place. It's in Puerto Rico, which is very unusual, and it's going to be June 26th through the 28th. The board has consistently sent the executive director, the board chair at the time of registration, and then the next would be the discipline that the meeting was in, meaning sometimes we have social work meetings, sometimes we have counseling meetings, sometimes we have MFT meetings. With all that being said, if the board continues to move that direction, it would be myself and Chairperson Meek, and then the third person to be considered. I don't know if I reached out to you, Dr. Bailey. Is this something you're interested in doing?
Knowing where I'm at in my appointment?
Yeah. That's a fair statement.
I recognize that.
Okay.
It sounds wonderful, but yeah. I would not like to take that from somebody.
So Dr. Bailey's on a year carryover on her appointment, so she's technically, she's appointed, but she's a carryover. I will tell you that I reached out to the other members that weren't going to be here to make sure that it was fair. And including Mr. Shen, and the only one that showed of any interest was Lynette Hennigan, also would like to go. And I know that Ms. Palacios would like to go. My recommendation to the board is to consider their past pattern, and in this particular case, since the counseling conference,
Even though that I know that Dr. Hennigan's interested, Ms. Palacios is a counseling professional member, and that's all I have. But it is a vote, and we do have to vote because they have to register and move forward. And it's fully funded, if I didn't say that.
So we're voting for the three. Okay. Yeah. And you're proposing Ms. Palacios because it makes sense with the conference? And the
because of the disciplinary piece. She, when I say disciplinary, because of the discipline. She's a counselor. But not, you know, I know that Dr. Hennigan would love to go, and if there's nobody else available, but being that Ms. Palacios is a counseling member.
Okay, so do we have a motion? Oh, go ahead.
Do I need to put a motion in? Okay, so I move to have Toby, Dr. Meek, and then Ms. Palacios go to the Puerto Rican. Sorry. It's the counseling summit.
Do I have a second?
Bailey, second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Motion carries.
All right. All right. So, today is Megan's last day with us. As you all know from the email that I sent out to all of the board members, she's accepted a position as head counsel with the governor's office, which would be a
senior counsel.
Senior counsel. Isn't that the same thing?
They might read these minutes.
Okay. Senior counsel for the governor's office, and therefore it would be a conflict of interest for her to remain. So today is her last board meeting with us. And I just, you know, I've known Ms. Kramer for 8 years now in a couple of different capacities. Thank you. Capacities. So as excited as I am for her, I definitely have mixed emotions because not only has she been such a huge support of our board, but a huge support of me. And so I just want to thank you for your service. And I know that we will continue to work together and so forth. But I think it's a huge loss for our board.
Thank you. And I want to say a couple things. I am someone who has benefited tremendously from therapy in my life. And so as a member of the public, you know, it's the work we do is very important. And also I'm someone who in my professional capacity has a significant number of clients with mental illness. And I also know that that work can be, you know, very difficult, challenging, and also critically important. And so for, you know, considering our dual purpose, I think the work that this board does is so important, and yet that public service is kind of thankless. And I could wish for no finer fellow board members than the people I've served with. And that goes for both the public members and the clinicians. I've learned so much from you guys, and I know you'll continue to do excellent work. And to the staff and Toby and Mona and everybody, this has been, you know, I read the newspaper. Sometimes I read bad things about other boards. Unfortunately, this board is a class act, and the group of people who are working for it, you all walk the walk and talk the talk, and it's been just a privilege to serve with you. And someone said recently, one of the folks we had in front of us, that, you know, the investigators treated her with dignity and respect. And I just thought that was so nice. You know, that's your job, and you guys are doing it so well. And I just wanted to thank you guys. And, you know, there's not enough therapists in the world. And I know the work can be, you all do very difficult work and will continue to do good work. And I'm just proud to have been a part of it. So thank you very much.
Miss you.
Yeah,
we'll miss you. We'll miss you. You'll be very missed.
So I don't know if I'm going to get to the next one. So somebody's going to have to bail me out if I can't. But I think that this is an opportunity that that we need to share, that Dr. Davis is not with us today. He passed away a couple weeks back. Again, he served 13 and a half years, more than 13 and a half years in various capacities. That's how long I've known him.
And again, this is somebody that's always supported our board and has supported me personally and professionally. I remember when I was first appointed to the board in 2014, I won't even go down that road, but he was my biggest fan. And he's probably one of the few people of why I'm still here today, because of his support. And I know we're all going to miss him, but I just think I wanted to make sure that we took time to honor him today because he was still a serving member at the time of his death. And I'll never forget in November, he came to our board all the way up until December. And in December, I called him. I'm like, are you going to be available? And he's like, well, I can be if you need me for quorum. But he wasn't feeling well. And that has a lot to say about him and who he was. If I would have said, yeah, Doc, we need you for quorum, he would have been here. But he was definitely a stand-up guy, a stand-up person, stand-up board member, and I would imagine a stand-up clinician. So I just needed to go on record to say that.
Very kind individual to everybody. I think that he was, supportive of the board and the staff, but also the clinicians and the complainants. He had that very kind stand to who he was.
All right. So with that being said, I have informed the governor's office we are now on fire with our lack of appointments, with Ms. DeBrotz leaving, with Megan leaving, with Doc leaving. We're in a position now where quorum is going to be an issue, because you all have personal lives and you're going to be, vacant from time to time. So right now, we're at that position where it's going to get really, really difficult. So, a couple of things, the governor's office is aware of it. I know that they are in the process of interviewing a few people. I also know nothing happens quickly. But that goes to my next point. We really need to be vigilant and mindful of attendance at our meetings for the next couple of months, because it's really going to put us in a bad spot. Today we had 6 disciplinary actions on our agenda. We usually have about 15. So I suspect February and March you're going to see that again. So just be mindful of that. Again, we recognize you have your own professional and personal lives, but be mindful that it's going to be tight for a while. That also means when you get that agenda a week before, to really, take a look at that agenda to see if there's anything that you need to recuse from, as that kind of helps us move forward with that. The next thing on the agenda is also on for an action vote, and this is in regards to appointing additional members to the personnel subcommittee. So let me just briefly tell you who was on it, and then I'll briefly tell you what that looks like. And then you'll either volunteer or be voluntold by your peers. So who was on it was, or still is on it, is Adelisa and Diane. Who was on it was Patty DeBrotz, Megan Kramer, and Cedric Davis. So we're now down to 2 members. We really need 3 more members. What that looks like, this personnel subcommittee was developed about 5 years ago, and it's really set up to develop for my annual review. Or any other actions that may need to be considered in regards to my performance throughout the year. Typically what that looks like is the months of March, April, and May. We will meet 30 minutes before the actual board meeting. And that's really the only extra requirement there is. What will happen is next month we're going to provide you a presentation in regards to board staff's accomplishments. And then in March, and we will be asking for board members' review of myself. And then March, you will meet together. Really, the person that does most of the work is going to be Chairperson Meek, who takes in everybody's information and develops the review based on that. So, again, today we need 3 individuals to volunteer for that. And to consider that. But at this time, for the last 5 years, those have been the only extra rules or responsibilities that you had to do.
If you need a public member, I'll do the public member spot.
We can always have 2 public members.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. One more?
I thought we need 2 more. Who else said?
Charles,
you don't have many left to, so I guess I would love to.
Volunteer
for your
fantastic.
Nobody left, so I'll come forward.
You can volunteer like
Polly. She's not here.
So we would need a motion for that. We would be motioning to appoint Antoine Trotter, Robert Charles, and Mark Shen to the personnel subcommittee. I think I just made the motion.
You made the motion.
Bailey, so moved.
Second, Kramer.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Congratulations. Hope to have you. So who's the only one not on it? Is this Polly?
Hennigan, Polly, Dr.
And,
okay. I know, but Mary. I might be leaving.
Yeah. I doubt it.
All right. Anything else? On your, okay. Item 15, call for public comment. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any given public matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 5 minutes to do so, pursuant to ARS 38431.01H. The board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Actions on public comment matters that are not listed on the agenda will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to schedule the matter for further discussion at a later date. Do we have any board members that want to address public members that want to address the board? We have one. Come on in, please.
And everything.
Yes, and state your name for the record, please.
My name is Anna Lowen, and I am shaking because I just got my LPC yesterday.
Congratulations.
And I wanted to let you guys know that I appreciate it, and it was a long road, and I didn't realize you had 311 other people, and so I appreciate the work that you guys do, and yesterday was a very joyful day for me, so thanks.
For the record, could you spell your last name?
Sure. Lowen. And there's an LPC after that. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Anybody else want to address the board? No? Okay. So next meeting is February 9th at 9 a.m. If you have any reasons, or if you're not able to attend, please let Ms. Zavala know as soon as possible. And I appreciate Ms. Zavala's reminder when she sent the email last week to really look at the cases real quick to see there anybody that needs to be recused. And so with that said, meetings adjourned at 1:14 p.m.
We need a motion.
Oh, motion to adjourn, Trotter.
Bailey, second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting adjourned at 1:14 p.m. Thank you.